Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising again.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We've got Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future going to be here talking about the big Conservapalooza event that happened over the weekend, where all of the glass-eyed ideologues gathered for their big rah-rah session, where they're out there spewing their platitudes and their real special brand of hatred. So we'll talk to him about that. Should be very interesting. Also, Robert Craig, director of Citizens Action Wisconsin, going to be here talking about the Wisconsin governor threatening to call out the National Guard on state workers. And kind of a test case, I think, for the rest of the nation. NotMyWisconsin.com is the website. Robert will be here talking about the threats. And really, I'm looking at what's going on in Wisconsin as kind of the test case, kind of that feeling out moment to see what the reaction across the country is going to be. So I'm thinking if we don't see overwhelming negative reaction to this, and so far we've seen some good negative reaction to this, this could spread across Michigan, Indiana, Missouri, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, all of the states that are talking about doing some type of bizarre right-to-work stuff. I think that if there's not a political price here, we could see even Ohio, especially Ohio with Kasich. Also, Barry Mortimer from the Steelworkers Union going to be here talking about Manufacturing Monday, a product that we make here in the United States by union workers. A light bulb, Sylvania. Now, this I just found out about this a couple of months ago. Sylvania makes a light bulb. Looks like the old light bulbs that we used to love, the incandescent ones. You screw them into your thing there, and everything's wonderful. It gives off a better light, energy efficient, and no mercury. So we don't have to buy those curly Q ones. We can buy one of these made right here, and Barry will talk to us about that. Also, State Representative Lawrence Curry is going to be here talking about redistricting in the third hour. So you'll want to stick around for that. The Tea Twizzlers are all happy. They have forced Republicans to push forward and to honor their grand pledge. You remember the pledge? The big 48-page color brochure document, 27 pages of pictures, a good conservative book, lots of flowery, happy, smiling white people in pictures, and then 21 pages of equally flowery words, mostly redundant, cut and paste, without very much substance. But one thing they did say is they were going to cut $100 billion. So the Tea Twizzlers are going to keep them to that. Now, remember, a few weeks back, Republicans wanted to cut about $32 billion. Mostly on the backs of the poor and disadvantaged, typical Republican MO. But we haven't seen that so far, so it'll be interesting. Today, President Obama came out with his budget, some cuts, not slashes, not the deep, drastic cuts that the GOP were asking for. He is putting the brakes on 2 years of what some are calling big spending increases. Personally, I think they were necessary spending increases. They were what kept us from collapsing as an economy. They are what kept this country from a Great Depression. So I got to give the man credit. Right now, I'm kind of looking at this year as 1936. Kind of looking at, FDR was looking down the road, said, you know, we'd spend a bunch of money. Conservatives talked him into, hey, let's cut the budget. Hey, oh, let's cut back. Let's cut back. I'm hoping that we don't see the same kind of results. Anyway, the president unveiled his $3.2 trillion budget plan today, freezing and in some cases reducing safety net programs for the poor. Again, not enough for the Republicans. They wanted deep, painful, massive cuts. You know, screw those poor people. Let them starve. Even though the president says his budget makes tough choices and sacrifices, I'm personally not seeing the sacrifice at the top. There are no cuts or changes to Social Security or Medicare. Good for him. Republicans, you know, I saw John McCain over the weekend on Meet the Depressed, and that's all he seemed to talk about. Well, the American people, he said, need to wake up and realize that we need to cut some of these programs. We need to look at them. Now, understand, the military budget, can't talk about that. Because after all, we're in a war, according to him. A war that we should be getting out of. But no, can't touch that. So everything really in the budget that the president laid out is kind of dependent on economic recovery and an increased revenue. So I'm hoping that we're not going to see another 1936, or it could be very, very painful. The Obama plan trades cuts to domestic programs to pay for increases in education, infrastructure, and research. And we really, really, honestly and truthfully, education, infrastructure, R&D, things we need to be investing in as a nation. But again, we're not asking the upper crust to do anything. So his plan calls for the Bush, and I'm saying now Bush/Obama tax handouts to end, which will return some $1.6 trillion in revenue back to our coffers. Understand, we were held hostage back in December by the Republicans to give out those massive handouts to our upper crust so that we could get, you know, a few crumbs for the unemployed, a few crumbs in the way of unemployment benefits, food stamps, that stuff. You know, big, massive pound of flesh, a couple of crumbs for those folks at the bottom. So those making more than $250,000 a year will see the handouts expire in 2 years. I think that's a good thing. Should have expired January 1st, and return that money back to the coffers. To, you know, if we're that bent on deficit reduction, don't you think asking those who, can afford a little extra cheese on their hamburger, kick back a little bit. Anyway, that's just the way I see it. Jacob Lew, he's one of Obama's budget guys, told ABC's Good Morning America that the budget for fiscal 2012 has $400 billion in savings, and it's going to bring our discretionary domestic spending down to levels not seen since Dwight Eisenhower was in the White House. So lots on the chopping block, but some investments. So as the days go on, we're going to see how these things roll out. I saw $405 million in cuts to community block grants. I looked at areas like this. That kind of money is important to rural areas for investment. So it'll be interesting as we go forward where this turns out, and I'm looking for more numbers as we come. Now, tomorrow the Republicans are going to come out, and they're going to have their big heyday thing. And I guess Big Bird and Sesame Street are on the chopping block, so we may be having Big Bird for lunch tomorrow because the Republicans want to destroy the Public Broadcasting Corporation, because we can no longer have actual news, in their opinion. So that'll be interesting. Yesterday, being Sunday, spent the day with the family, had a great day. We invited our new pastor from our church over to the house and her family over. And I got to say, what really cool people. Our pastor, her name's Stephanie, her and her family come from Germany. She speaks very good English. Her husband, pretty good. The kids, not at all. But, you know, my kids and their kids got along really well, played air hockey and did all that stuff. But really, really cool people and really interesting folks. And we had a long conversation about religion and the whole direction of the countries and the globe. And the reason I bring this up is this woman, Nail Cooper. She is the national coordinator of the Church of Action on Poverty. She has a piece over at Christian Today that I thought was kind of worth talking about on a day when you're talking about budgets. Because she asked the question, are you ready to pledge to close the gap? And what she's talking about is she's talking about closing the gap between those who have an enormous amount and those who have nothing. And when you talk about Christianity, for me, it's peace and social justice. Now, our religious right in this country, the people who were at the CPAC meeting, they don't see social justice in anything having to do with religion or Christianity, which I find quite ironic, which is why I have a problem with the religious right. But this woman goes on to ask the question, can we pass by on the other side when banks prepare to hand out multi-million pound bonuses to a few whilst others struggle to make ends meet? She writes, as Christians, we must be concerned when we hear that the yawning gap between rich and poor in our own country is now at record levels. Church Action on Poverty, they have launched this new program encouraging churches and individual Christians to pledge to close that gap. And she points out that the UK is now the sixth richest tree on the planet, but one increasingly characterized by inequality between rich and poor. Now, we're right up there at the very top as the most unequal. She goes on to say the total wealth of the richest tenth of the population is now almost 100 times greater than the poorest tenth, a gap higher than that it has ever been in their country. So she asks the question, does inequality matter? And she goes on to say that if you look at places that have high inequality, where they're very rich and there are massive numbers of very, very poor, you have lower life expectancies, higher crime rates, higher illiteracy rates, much worse health outcomes, on, and as she goes on. And she says, some may say, so what to these problems? It's just something that you're going to have to get used to and get on with. But she says, for Christians, this is no answer. Our faith tells us that another world is possible, as Martin Luther King said, deeply etched in the fiber of our religious tradition is the conviction that all are made in the image of God, both rich and poor, are tied in a single garment of destiny. And again, I go back to this because you look here in the U.S., where income equality is really, as a nation, we're at very, very different ends, where the bottom 20th percent, that bottom fifth, the bottom 20% of the folks, they are massively in debt. While you're looking at the very top 1%, they have massive wealth. The Economic Policy Institute did a study that they do every year, the state of the U.S., where they go through and they rate the lowest 20, the next 20, the middle, and then the upper middle 20%, and they find that the lowest 20% as a number are in debt about $27,000. The next 20% has a net worth of about $5,000. The next 20% about $65,000. The next 20% about $200,000. So you're looking at that 80%. Now, where the income really gets crazy is the top 5%. If you're in that top 5% number, you're looking at about almost $1 million in wealth if you're in the top 5%. The next 4%, you're looking at almost $3 million. And if you're in that very top 1%, you're looking at almost $14 million. Now, explain to me how it's possible that folks at the very top, those folks who are worth about $14 million, can have more wealth than the bottom 60% at least. It doesn't make an awful lot of sense. And it's something that we need to look into. It's something that we need to fight back on. And I think policy is the way to go. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future, find out what happened at CPAC this weekend.
Not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show. All right.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You work full-time? You shouldn't be living in poverty. Not in America. So today I'm issuing an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour.
President Obama on Wednesday used his executive order power to raise the minimum wage of workers employed by federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. Standing behind him were fast food workers who worked for McDonald's, Wendy's, and KFC. Alexis Vasquez was one of those workers. He works at a Smithsonian Museum McDonald's and is active in the fight to raise fast food wages with Good Jobs Nation.
I was very excited, not just because I met the president and the most powerful man in the world. I was excited to know that a guy that powerful is on our side, supporting us, and it means a lot what he's done for us. It was just so much excitement and thinking about there's more possibility. His words filled me with joy. Everything he said was just beautiful. You know, even himself said that he wasn't going to stop at 10-10. He was going to continue supporting us. That made me want to do something.
As he took action on his own to raise wages of workers working for federal contractors, Obama called on Congress to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour.
10-10. Let's get that done. Raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10 wouldn't just raise wages for minimum wage workers. Its effect would lift wages for about 28 million Americans. It would lift millions of Americans out of poverty immediately. It would help millions more work their way out of poverty without requiring a single dollar in new taxes or spending.
As the Democratic U.S. president was taking action on his own to raise wages for workers, Republicans in Wisconsin were busy trying to make sure that cities in the state cannot enact living wage ordinances. A Wisconsin Assembly bill, AB 750, is being rushed through the legislature. It would use state law to prohibit cities and local units of government throughout Wisconsin from enacting their own living wage ordinances to raise wages for workers. Governor Scott Walker has already used GOP control of state power to wipe out a paid sick day requirement for workers in Milwaukee. City residents wanted. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee began voting on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union Wednesday. Voting will wrap up on Friday. Anti-union Tennessee Republican politicians are going to extremes to oppose UAW membership for the VW workers, even though VW itself is neutral on the union election and works well with unions. UAW Local 1853 Chair Mike Heron says it was the UAW and collective bargaining with GM that reopened the GM plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee that had been shut down during the Great Recession. Heron says statements made by these anti-union politicians in Tennessee that union workers somehow hurt economic development are dead wrong. Collective bargaining in Spring Hill brought $350 million in investments and more than 1,800 jobs to the plant as union representation reopened that idled auto factory. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
You can't go wrong with fancy cookies. You can never go wrong with fancy cookies. And a clear indication that President Obama's place of birth will continue to simmer as political controversy, the opening of state legislative sessions this year has seen 10 different birther bills introduced. The measures would require presidential candidates on the state's ballots to be an American citizen. Leo Berman, Republican state representative from Texas, said, "We don't think the president was vetted, and it's just that simple." Interestingly enough, African-American conservative pundit and talk show host Herman Cain told CPAC this past weekend that stupid people are ruining America. You mean like the people who keep bringing up this legislation about show me the birth certificate? You mean people like Republicans who are doing everything they can do to hide the fact that they have no idea how to fix the economy? Yeah, those stupid people. You're right, Herman. You're right. Anyway, this past weekend was Conservapalooza, where every wannabe right-wing nut felt right at home and free to spew their very special brand of hatred for our nation under the coating of red, white, and blue. A place where someone like Herman Cain can be considered a presidential candidate. Figure that one out. Anyway, our friend Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future spent a little time in conservative Lollapalooza land, and he's here to tell us a little bit about it. Terrence, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I gotta ask you, as an African-American at Conservapalooza, Did you feel out of place?
I was comforted somewhat by an invitation which I declined to join the Christmas Addicts Tea Party. But I, oddly enough, I felt kind of invisible, but not out of place. I was there as media and observing, really, and listening to what people had to say. And what surprised me more about what I heard was what I didn't hear. And that was about jobs.
Right. Because they have no clue. I mean, aside from the whining and complaining about abolishing the Department of Education and the Department of Environmental Protection, wanting to end Social Security and repeal Obamacare,
right.
Was there anything new from our conservative friends, anything at all?
Honestly, no. I went through, I listened to the speeches, I went through the exhibit hall and looked at all of the things that they have there, and I saw everything from the group advocating the consumption tax,
nice.
Tax to some petition to, I don't know, repeal a ban on light bulbs, but very little about how they're going to create jobs and stimulate economic growth. And I realize when progressives talk about jobs and conservatives talk about jobs, we're not talking about the same thing.
No.
When progressives talk about jobs, we're talking about actively and directly investing in job creation and literally actively creating jobs. And the closest I was able to get to that from CPAC was that if you, I don't know, cut all of the things that they want to cut, including about, I don't even know how much money from WIC, among other things, that job growth and economic growth will just happen.
Well, let me help you here, Terrence, because I have figured this out for everyone. People on the left, they actually have a vision, have an idea of how to create jobs. There's infrastructure we need built. There's a whole bunch of things that we need that we could create jobs with. Republicans, they believe in the invisible man with the invisible hand, and that'll take care of it. And Michelle Bachmann, she had this brilliant nugget that I want to share with you.
Markets work. Let them.
See, that's it. Free markets work. That's it. That's the answer to our problems, Terrence.
And that depends on what you prioritize. If you believe that there are things that need doing and must be done and should be done, whether they're profitable or not, then the free market works for some things, but it doesn't necessarily work for everything. But what I saw most of all at CPAC was something that I think is, to me, defines the trouble that conservatives at the GOP are in, whether they believe it or not. They're caught between two factions. There was a definite split
yep.
there with the popularity of Ron and Rand Paul on one end and the controversy over the group GO Proud on the other end. There is a serious split between two factions, neither of whom the majority of Americans really want anything to do with. You've got the social conservatives on one hand who are going in a different direction than the rest of the country is going, and you've got the fiscal conservative, libertarian-thinking conservative whose economic ideas are miles away from what the majority of people want. And what they don't understand is that yes, everyone will say, oh, we should reduce the budget, but most people will say, not my stuff. And if we really want to, you can try to find something to cut that will make nobody unhappy and everybody happy. And I think you'll round in circles trying to do that. If we want to focus on deficit reduction, the way to do that in the midst of this unemployment crisis is to focus on actively putting people back to work.
Long I absolutely time. Agree.
Put
you know, what's interesting to me, Terrence, though, is just how many people out there have no idea that what the Republicans are talking about cutting is things that they're benefiting from. You know, there was a poll done last week, and I think we're going to talk to the author. There was a study done last week that we're going to talk to the author tomorrow night, who goes through and talks about all of the things that people get that they don't realize, like, you know, the tax-wise.
Exactly.
Like the college credits, the Pell Grants, the mortgage deductions, all of this stuff that we don't realize is on the chopping block, and we, again, are going to lose.
And that is because a lot of people buy into the myth of the self-made American, that you stand alone and that you have received no help from anyone, from the state, from any government, and you are 100% self-made. And the reality is that we all get some kind of help, some kind of support, some kind of assistance at some point in our lives.
Yep.
And that's a good thing. I think what you're going to hear from conservatives in the next from now until 2012 on jobs is the kind of speech that Mitt Romney gave. He was the speaker that I heard mention jobs most often. But if I were to put it bluntly, he was all and no how.
Yep.
Because he spent his time talking about jobs.
I guess we lost his parents.
Are you still there?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay. For quote unquote failing to create jobs. Now, you know and I know that the Republicans in Congress have been actively killing jobs, letting job programs expire and job training programs expire, and refusing to extend them and refusing to fund them so that people who are actually earning paychecks will no longer do so. And their policies in terms of starving the states and not helping the states out, it will also lead to more people on the unemployment roll. But what you're going to hear is not what they're going to do about jobs, but criticizing the president and the Democrats in Congress for, quote unquote, failing to create jobs where they have never tried to.
Well, not failing to create jobs, not creating jobs fast enough for them.
Right.
Look, they dug us into a massive hole. They put us in this mess. It's going to take time to dig us out.
And I think that part of it is also that the reality is that the president, maybe the president, but definitely in the Senate, you've had a lot of people who spent way too much time listening to the Blue Dogs, many of whom are no longer there.
Good.
And whittling down programs that could have been much more and could have done much more at a time when we needed bold action. And things were whittled down and bargained away until they were so small in size that they could not hope to address the scope of the problem.
But, yeah, I look at the stimulus. 40% of it went out in tax breaks. We didn't need tax breaks.
Yeah.
We needed smart vision.
Yeah. And that means direct investment.
Absolutely.
In putting people to work. And you're not going to see that, of course, in the next 2 years from the Republicans. But I think that what this opens up is a window of opportunity for Democrats and progressives to show people a plan, present a plan that will create jobs, X number of jobs, and not just, well, we're going to do this and hope that it creates jobs. Here is where we are to invest in creating X number of jobs in the area in this place. Because what they're going to stumble over, what conservatives in the GOP are going to stumble over, is that there are millions and millions of Americans out there on various points along the political spectrum who just want something to work. And the GOP does not have any ideas that will work. They've presented the same old ideas that, frankly, got us into this mess.
Yeah, this is the same failed, tired ideology we're going to have to, I guess, go through once again. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future. OurFuture.org is the website. You know, Terrence, let's go back to CPAC for a moment.
Okay.
Did you get to see the Donald? Was his hair all coiffed and perfectly placed?
Yes.
President Donald.
It was kind of ironic for you know, the curiously coiffed Donald Trump to talk about America being a quote-unquote laughing stock, though we would with him in the White House. But it was also surreal when someone like Donald Trump has to actually be the voice of reason.
at CPAC.
Right.
And he got booed for saying, listen, Rod Paul is not going to get elected, folks. He's not going to be in the White House.
Nope.
And it's the truth, but nobody there the people there didn't want to hear it. But that's an example of what I was talking about the fiscally conservative libertarian wing of the GOP and of American conservatism are not pushing ideas the American people want. They're doing exactly the opposite of what the American people want. And at some point, these folks are going to go back to their districts and, heaven forbid, if they actually get to implement their ideas, they're going to hear about it from people. The Washington Post, just after the November election, did an extensive survey that showed that a majority of people want their representatives to fight for job creation at home in their district, even if it means more spending. A minority of people wanted cuts, even if it meant loss of jobs at home.
So that means those dreaded earmarks, which we find out that John Boehner, he brought home the bacon for his district.
Yes, they all do because they know what side their bread is buttered on. They have to. They talk one way in order to get to Washington, and then they act another way in order to stay in Washington. But in times like this, and moments of crisis like this, we don't have time. We don't have the luxury of time for that kind of back and forth. We need people who get up and make bold decisions and show us plans that will get us out of this mess and make people understand how they will work.
I agree. Of the people that you saw speaking, because I'm assuming that one of the people that spoke there this weekend will be the Republican nominee. Which one do you look more presidential?
Wow.
Or were they all? I mean, because I can't imagine Michelle Bachmann. Come on, that's a nice sideshow. Palin wasn't there, though she was. She's a complete sideshow, and she's. I don't think she's seriously in it. Like Donald, it's PR stunt time.
Here's the field that's shaping up so far. The most exciting people, like you said, are people like Michelle Bachmann, who's great for entertainment value, not going to get elected. Ron Paul, who's got his set of true believers, not going to get elected, not going to win the nomination. Mitt Romney, who looks good and sounds good, but even as I was standing in the media room at CPAC, I was listening to people muttering about, as he was giving his speech, well, yeah, but he's got that whole gay marriage thing and health care in Massachusetts around his neck.
And he's a Mormon.
Right, so he's probably not going to be in the running either. Sarah Palin, she, if you ask me, doesn't want to be president so much as she wants to be rich and famous. And as soon as she says whether she's going to run or not, there's not really much reason to pay attention to her. So she's not going to stay until she has to. And Donald Trump will have to wait until the latest season of The Apprentice wraps before he can get back to us. That leaves Pawlenty, Thune, Huntsman, and
Tricky Ricky Santorum.
Oh, Santorum. Right. Well, he could maybe have Palin as his VP. That would be good for, I don't know, ratings, entertainment value. And I think I'm forgetting, but Mike Huckabee.
Yeah, Huckleberry wasn't there, I don't think.
Did I leave anybody out?
Herman Cain.
Herman?
Him out.
Who?
Herman Cain.
Right. And who is the rent is too damn high? Who is that guy?
Oh, he's not there.
Oh, he was there at CPAC, let me tell you.
Was he really?
But, oh, yeah.
I wish I would have seen him, because I want that quote.
Oh, yeah, he was there with a band of followers who I'm not sure whether they were laughing with him or at him. But
that's
the shape of the GOP field right now, and there's no clear winner in there to me. There's no one in there that, A, can, I think, necessarily even unite the factions within the GOP that are growing further apart. And you've got the reasonable Republicans like, people like David Frum, who have been all but chased out of the party. So there are very few grown-ups in charge.
Oh, see, now that's why I love watching this, Terrence. And that's why I appreciate you coming on, giving us a little bit of information and giving us a little giggle there. Terrence, I appreciate your time, buddy.
Thank you so much.
Terrence Heath from the Campaign for America's Future. Future.org is their website. We're going to take it back after this. Call 888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-745. This is the Rick Smith, where working people come to talk.
Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We are AFSCME. Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
You know what we really are fighting for? We're fighting for all of the advancements that happened on the job. We're fighting for everything from the New Deal forward. We're fighting for the right to a decent life, a right to a decent wage, Social Security. We're fighting for all that stuff. And, you know, I look at people like Mike Lee, the Republican from Utah, who believes there's almost nothing constitutional about any progress we've made in the last 70 years. I look at the billionaire from West Virginia, who made his money the old-fashioned way. He inherited it from his grandparents, who exploited children and their parents, who worked their fingers to the bone just to exist so Mr. Racy could rail against child labor laws. And now you look at this woman from Missouri, State Senator Jane Cunningham, a Republican who represents the 7th senatorial district there in Missouri. I'm just going to read the bill that she has sponsored because I don't know what else to do with it. Senate Bill 222, it modifies child labor laws. This act modifies the child labor laws. It eliminates the prohibition on employment of children under the age of 14. Restrictions on the number of hours and restrictions when a child may work during the day are also removed. It also repeals the requirement that a child age 14 or 15 obtain a work certificate or work permit in order to be employed. Children under 16 will also be allowed to work in any capacity in a motel, resort, or hotel where sleeping accommodations are furnished. It also removes the authority of the director of the Division of Labor Standards to inspect employers who employ children and to require them to keep certain records for children they employ. It also repeals the presumption that the presence of a child in a workplace is evidence of employment. Stop for just 1 second and think about that piece of legislation. We're going to have kids under 16 working in hotels. As long as there are places for them to sleep that are furnished. The first thing that pops into my head is Lawrence Taylor. Lawrence Taylor, for some odd reason, pops into my head. You know, the guy who, the NFL star who's going to jail because he had sex with a 16-year-old prostitute. Come to think about that, hotel 16-year-old, not a combination I think is a very good thing, Jay.
No, not at all.
I look at the fact that now they're saying children under 14, no problem. Let them work to the bone. No restriction on hours, no restriction on days of the week, none of that. No, have to get a work permit. Don't worry about that. You can work in any capacity. No more oversight. We don't want anybody looking over the employer's shoulder to make sure that the kids aren't being abused and the wages stolen. Never mind any of that. No. Am I the only one who thinks this is really a bad idea? Now, Missouri is another state, much like Pennsylvania. Politically, much the same. They're pushing for right-to-work legislation. They're pushing for a lot of the same insanity that I think we're going to see here in Pennsylvania. I'm wondering if Daryl Metcalf has talked to Ms. Cunningham about Senate Bill 222, because what the heck? We've still got coal mines. We can get those kids back to work in the coal mines. You know, because evidently they're not getting an education, according to the Republicans. Just put them back to work. Put them in the mines. What do you think? Good idea? Yeah, let's put them kids. You know what? We can pay them less than minimum wage. Because who are they going to tell?
Rick, I mean, really, I understand your outrage, and you have a right to be outraged, but does it really surprise you? I think
this does.
I think these conservatives have been out of power so long, they take this as a great opportunity. This is their day in the sun, and they're going to go for the gold. They're going to go for everything that they wanted for the last 50 years. And this is just another one. Is this outrageous? Is this maybe another step? Absolutely. This harkens back to the 10 and 12 year olds in the mines who died by the thousands, by the way.
You know, I look at this and I ask the question, how far back do they want to take us? How far backward do conservatives want us to go? How far back to the robber baron era do we have to return? The inequality in wealth is already there. We are more of an unequal society than we were back then. And the problem is, I don't think most people realize the kind of wealth we're talking about. When I'm talking about the wealthy, I'm talking about the kind of wealth that you cannot even imagine. And I can imagine some pretty luxurious things. But your own island, your own 500-foot yacht, sorry, I'm not going there. Especially at a time where we're talking about taking money away from education, taking funding away from programs that help seniors. When we're talking about taking health care away from low-income workers, really? And now this? What more is it going to take before the working people of this country wake up that there is a class war going on and you are losing? You are losing badly. When we're talking about putting our children back into the workforce. I mean, it's not bad enough that unemployment's already low enough and wages have been stagnant and falling for three decades now. Now you want to put even more workers into the workforce to pull those wages down even further. You know, they say that the teen unemployment rate's like 28%. Do you know why the teen unemployment rate is so high? Because mom and dad are out there competing for the same jobs the teen used to take. In years past. Those jobs at McDonald's, those service jobs at hotels. Mom and dad are fighting for those jobs to be able to put food on the table. And now we got this nitwit who, you know, I got to be honest, whoever put her into office, you need to get your head examined. And here in this state, the craziness that's going to go on here, all of those union people who voted for Toomey and for Corbett, you're going to get what you deserve. The sad part about it is you're going to bring me with you. And that's the part that bothers me. We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What the heck? Let's put them back in the mines.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to ricksmithshow.com and download our podcast right there for your entertainment, your enjoyment. Take it on the road with you. If you're near your computer, you can watch us in the studio live at ricksmithshow.com. A funny story. A would-be bank robber in Rhode Island was foiled after a teller shut the security door and told him, sorry, bank's closed. Cranston police say it happened around 7 p.m. on Thursday, closing time at Citizens Bank inside the Stop and Shop grocery store. The police said that the man told the teller a note on a ripped paper plate and said, hey, this is a robbery. The teller pulled down the curtain and said, sorry, branch is closed. The guy ran away. Now police are looking for him. And while, you know, this is kind of a funny story, when they catch this guy, he's going to go to jail. And for a very long time. While I don't condone bank robbery or theft in general, I understand it. Poverty and desperation make people do some things that sometimes are shocking. My problem is when a desperate person acts out like this, they're punished severely. Because you can't steal from the wealth structure. Oh, no. They frown upon that. But when the wealth structure steals from the poor and working class, it's for our own good. Isn't that what they've been telling us? So let the thievery begin. On Friday, the Kentucky State Senate voted to pass a pension bill. The Lexington Herald Leader reported that the bill was designed to address the public pension fund's growing liability. They report, quote, Kentucky needs to stay ahead of the multi-billion dollar pension liability problem that is forcing tax hikes and painful spending reduction in other states, said the Republican senator backing the bill. It is just not affordable to go forward with our current plan for the state government and for local governments, according to Damian Thayer, Republican from Kentucky's Georgetown area. From a fairness perspective, taxpayers in the private sector struggle with layoffs, they write, stagnant wages and benefit cuts, yet they're expected to support generous public pensions far better than anything they will enjoy, he said. First part of it is far better than the private sector would enjoy, which, again, I go back to the reason you need to organize collective bargaining, might maybe get yourself some pension. But on the other side of this, all we keep hearing is about the outrageous stuff. That's all we keep hearing. The guy who got $1 million and tripled their salary for life. Yeah, like a couple of these state legislators over here. And, yeah, I think a couple of them we need to deal with. But we got to ask ourselves, who gets these pensions? The reality is the vast majority of people who retire from public sector work, they get a very minimal pension. Somewhere between, what, $19,000 and $24,000?
Around. That's accurate.
For me, I ask the other questions. Not how do we steal from people who are living on a very minimal pension. Why are we talking about cutting into the fees that go to Wall Street? I mean, after all, they're the ones who created this mess. They're the one who crashed the economy. They're the reason pension funds are in the crapper in the first place. Why are we looking at them? Why are we not looking at transaction taxes? Maybe looking at the fees that Wall Street takes for handling the public sector pensions. According to economist Dean Baker, he says that Wall Street fees cost public pension funds almost $15 billion every single year. Why aren't we looking at that? Wouldn't that be a good place to start? Wouldn't it? I think it'd be a pretty good place to start. And if you don't believe there's a war on working people, there is a perfect place. Because there is. There is absolutely a war on workers in this country. Right now it's the public sector workers who are under the gun. But remember, folks, we're all in the shark tank. It's just how long that shark gets hungry for you. And I look at Wisconsin. The governor there has threatened to send out the National Guard against the state workers. Now understand, what's happening in Wisconsin is a testing ground. And don't think for a minute that Kasich in Ohio and Corbett here in Pennsylvania, Rick Snyder in Michigan, Mitch Daniels in Indiana, and governors in New Hampshire and Missouri and the other free states, don't think for a second that they're not watching to see what response comes. To me, this is 1981 all over again. This is Reagan firing the Patco workers. If we don't answer this attack with equal energy, we might as well pack our bags and head off to work camps and the company towns that are sure to come. Because nobody's safe. These people want to take us back to the age of the robber baron, where you worked for the corporate masters. It's not about, look, they've done nothing to create jobs. All they keep talking about is giving more to the wealthy, more tax cuts, more slashing taxes for corporations. Florida, for instance, Rick Scott goes to every length to destroy anything left of the safety net. But what's he do? He wants to eliminate corporate taxes. In Iowa, in Ohio, across all these states, you're seeing these folks going after public sector workers. And what I'm saying is you look at what's going on in Egypt. Labor activists are making history. Breaking away from their government-run unions. They're forming their own independent labor centers. Activists in the new Egyptian Federation of Independent Unions are demanding, get this, they're demanding a higher minimum wage for workers and a new maximum wage for their bosses. This is a first step towards reversing that massive inequality in the country. That maximum, according to the new federation, will be fixed at 10 times the nation's minimum wage. 10 times the nation's minimum wage. You know, if we were to do something like that, how high do you think the minimum wage would be? Because you know the wealthy, they want to make some money. Anyway, the Egyptian workers, the Federation declares, want a society that does not allow the few to buy private jets while the rest of the population cannot even afford public transportation. And to me, it's very simple, Jake.
And I find it ironic, and now think about this, and this has happened before. Here you have a party, the Republican Party, that was cheering on this rebellion in Egypt, and they should have. You have to admire the Egyptian people. Yet at home, what are they doing? They're trying to take away rights. Where the Egyptian people are trying to gain their freedom, gain more rights here, they're trying to take them away. And what the deep, dark secret is that, in fact, the stage was set. The rebellion was the outcome of years of agitation where the rubber meets the road in Egypt, and the labor movement was at the vanguard of that, fighting for basic justice every day at the work sites. And that spilled over into a gigantic movement that's been hugely successful and apparently is having impact on four or five other countries in that region. Amazing, just absolutely amazing. We are at historic times the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, what I'm hoping is some of that enthusiasm, some of that energy, some of that use of social media, flows here. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't answer these kind of attacks, if working people don't wake up and realize that, you know what, oops, we've made a massive mistake, it's game over.
And I don't know if you saw the man. He was, I think he worked, did he work for Google?
Google, yeah.
He was kind of the mastermind, and that was key. That was key, what he did for the people of Egypt when the Egyptian government tried to cut them off. That was masterful. That was a key to informing the people what was going on. Oh, and by the way, in Iran, the last couple of weeks, when they saw what was happening in Egypt, even though the public persona was that they were backing what was happening in Egypt, in their own country, they were cutting back access to cell phones and Google and Twitter and all that, because they knew that the exact thing that happened in Egypt was going to be happening in their country. And I left tonight. I was watching. They're having some pretty nasty riots now in the streets of Tehran. So it'll be interesting to see what comes out of that.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. When we come back, Robert Craig, director of Citizens Action Wisconsin, their website, notmywisconsin.com. We're going to talk about what the governor out there is doing, and maybe we can see what Governor Corbett is going to do here. We're right back after this.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith. It's the Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
If you work full-time, you shouldn't be living in poverty. Not in America. So today I'm issuing an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour.
President Obama on Wednesday used his executive order power to raise the minimum wage of workers employed by federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. Standing behind him were fast food workers who worked for McDonald's, Wendy's, and KFC. Alexis Vasquez was one of those workers. He works at the Smithsonian Museum McDonald's and is active in the fight to raise fast food wages with Good Jobs Nation.
I was very excited, not just because I met the president and the most powerful man in the world. I was excited to know that a guy that powerful is on our side, supporting us, and it means a lot that what he, it means a lot what he's done for us. It was just so much excitement and thinking about there's more possibility. His words filled me with joy. Everything he said was just beautiful. You know, even himself said that he wasn't going to stop at 10-10. He was going to continue supporting us. That made me want to do something.
As he took action on his own to raise wages of workers working for federal contractors, Obama called on Congress to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour.
10-10. Let's get that done. Raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10 wouldn't just raise wages for minimum wage workers. Its effect would lift wages for about 28 million Americans. It would lift millions of Americans out of poverty immediately. It would help millions more work their way out of poverty without requiring a single dollar in new taxes or spending.
As the Democratic U.S. president was taking action on his own to raise wages for workers, Republicans in Wisconsin were busy trying to make sure that cities in the state cannot enact living wage ordinances. A Wisconsin Assembly bill, AB 750, is being rushed through the legislature. It would use state law to prohibit cities and local units of government throughout Wisconsin from enacting their own living wage ordinances to raise wages for workers. Governor Scott Walker has already used GOP control of state power to wipe out a paid sick day requirement for workers in Milwaukee that city residents wanted. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee began voting on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union Wednesday. Voting will wrap up on Friday. Anti-union Tennessee Republican politicians are going to extremes to oppose UAW membership for the VW workers, even though VW itself is neutral on the union election and works well with unions. UAW Local 1853 Chair Mike Heron says it was the UAW and collective bargaining with GM that reopened the GM plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, that had been shut down during the Great Recession. Heron says statements made by these anti-union politicians in Tennessee that union workers somehow hurt economic development are dead wrong. Collective bargaining in Spring Hill brought $350 million in investments and more than 1,800 jobs to the plant as union representation reopened that idled auto factory.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
That's what it's going to take. Lots of organizing, lots of grassroots groups coming together and fighting back. You know, I look on this day back in 1996 after more than a year and a half on the picket line. Striking workers at Detroit's newspapers offered to return to work. A week later, the offer was accepted. However, the newspapers, they vowed to keep some of their 1,200 scabs who crossed the picket line. A year later, a court order made the company take back 1,100 former strikers. And the reason I bring this up is what most people don't know about this particular strike is that the Detroit Newspapers Incorporated, they were the owners of the News and the Free Press, they had gone out and they had hired nearly 1,000 Huffmaster and Vance International paramilitary security guards. You know, good old-fashioned strike breakers, skull crackers. Not to mention they paid the Sterling Heights police handsomely to intimidate and physically attack striking workers. And my fear is that we may see these kind of days revisited more and more in the future, especially as you look to Wisconsin. And I'm saying Wisconsin is the testing ground for every other governor, Corbett here in Pennsylvania, Kasich in Ohio. This is the testing ground right here in Wisconsin, and we better take quick notice. So I've asked Robert Craig, he's the executive director of Citizen Action Wisconsin, their website, notmywisconsin.com. Robert, thanks for taking time for me.
Great to be here, Rick.
The governor has threatened to use the National Guard. Let me ask you first and foremost, are there any National Guard left in Wisconsin, or are they all in Iraq?
That's a very good question. There seem to be some because some of them took offense at our press release today. So there are at least some here thinking that by saying that Governor Walker shouldn't be invoking the National Guard in a before there's even a labor dispute at all, that somehow we're, you know, impugning the National Guard. But we may see, because the first large-scale protest is tomorrow at the state capitol.
Right. I got to be honest. If I were in the National Guard, I think I would be very angry about being used as a enforcer against working people in my own home state.
Yeah, I'd agree. And the governor went out of his way when he announced his budget repair bill, which included abrogating negotiating rights for almost all public employees in the whole state, to say that he talked to the National Guard, that they were ready, that he was saying they wouldn't necessarily be necessary, but you have to prepare for the worst and that they'd be fully prepared and have all the equipment they needed. So clearly, you know, in the old union-busting technique, trying to suggest to all public employees, and we're talking about state, municipal, school teachers, that if they protest, that there's the threat of force behind the governor's actions.
Yeah, I got to be honest. The thought of the National Guard shooting my third-grade teacher for walking the picket line scares me.
Yeah, and we haven't gotten to that point. At this point, what we're looking at is him simply invoking that, I think, in order to coerce and intimidate and reduce protests. So his whole line has been that public employees, if they look at this, they'll see that they're doing better with his plan, that it's all reasonable, but their union leaders are trying to incite them into taking action, that he's ready for that.
You know, I look at what's going on in Wisconsin there, and as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but Wisconsin was the first state in the country to grant public sector workers the right to collective bargaining back in 58, which eventually led to JFK granting the right to federal employees. And I look at this as that really that symbolic moment. If he's able to do this in Wisconsin, really the home of the right to organize for public workers, what is that going to say in Ohio and Michigan and here in Pennsylvania?
I agree with you, and Ask Me Local One is in Madison, Wisconsin. So you're absolutely right that it started here, and this Governor Walker, is extremely ambitious, and this has been plotted at the national level. So I think that this is all part of something that they definitely intend to spread nationally. And in fact, he hopes, I think, to move up and potentially be a vice presidential candidate in 2012 because he's a rising star. And so this is not some isolated incident where one governor is just off on his own program. This is part of a national strategy, and they figure if they can do it in Wisconsin, they can do it in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Michigan, Ohio, and elsewhere.
So how do we stop him? What's the game plan? I mean, some of the response I've seen, I'm not all that encouraged by. I'm hoping tomorrow big rally. I'm hoping that he takes a beating for this.
There have been spontaneous pickets all over the state in front of state legislators' houses and offices, and there are just town hall meetings all over the state springing up, candlelight vigils, all sorts of other actions. The problem is that we have complete, not just Republican control, but right-wing Republican control, and the only thing that can stop this is three Republican votes in the Senate switching. There are that many reasonable Republicans in the state Senate, but they're going to have to buck their own governor, which is a very hard ask.
Right.
And so it's a question of, I think, some of this stuff's going to go through, like the health care and pension give back, which are unfair because public workers in Wisconsin actually make less, even if you factor in benefits, than private sector works by 8.5%. But the way it's set up now, they will not be able to have unions at all. They eliminate dues checkoff. So there's no way to even collect dues. They say that you have to have annual certification elections. I mean, you can only negotiate for base wages, but there could be no increase over consumer price index unless you have a referendum. And so it is absolutely impossible. There's no reason for people to even have the union because they'll have no power. And, of course, there's no more fair share, which means no one has to join the union, and even if it's representing them. But the whole unit votes on whether to keep the unity or not every year. So it's a very carefully contrived setup by national right-wing experts to say unions are technically possible but make them impossible. I think that the NEA, AFSCME, and the AFT in Wisconsin will probably disappear if this passes. It's hard to see them surviving, and we'll lose three-quarters of SEIU members. So this is incredibly draconian, and I think it will endanger other states if Governor Walker is successful.
He
wants a vote in less than a week. I mean, he introduced this on Friday. They want to vote this Wednesday or Thursday.
Yeah, so much for accountability, oversight, and transparency.
Oh, there's no chance of public input. This wasn't campaigned on. The public barely understands what's going on. The governor's side is saying that it doesn't get rid of the right to organize at all. It's just lying through its teeth about this and saying it's just about public employees paying their share of the budget deficit. And so the vast majority of the public may not even understand what's happening until it happens. The only chance that doesn't happen, of course, is just spontaneous protests from union members and from all like-minded like-minded people in solidarity in the next couple days.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're with Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizens Action Wisconsin. NotMyWisconsin.com is their website. We'll put a link at ours at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'll just click on Robert Craig's name. You know, why to the people who aren't union members, why is what's going on important to workers, both union and non-union?
Well, I mean, one thing is that, quite frankly, the right to form a union, if you take it away from public sector workers, even makes it even harder for private sector workers. Furthermore, quite frankly, these are some of the remaining family-sustaining jobs in the state, and so you actually harm the whole economy. I think small business owners will find it problematic if public employees have a lot less money to spend. And then you look at quality of services. How are we going to retain good teachers, good staff in the universities? This abrogates collective bargaining rights in the University of Wisconsin system. Home care workers lose their bargaining rights. If you don't have higher quality standards for home care workers, then you have terrible turnover and don't have quality services for seniors. So it's the services, it's the family-supporting jobs, and it's the whole precedent. We know that the State Chamber of Commerce, Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce, has been saying that by doing this, that this will actually lower wages overall for private sector workers as well. So this is a race to the bottom for all workers, and public workers are the current, you know, cutting edge and the scapegoat,
you know,
for all of this.
I've been saying this is 1981 all over again. How labor handles this, how the communities handle this. I'm saying this is the firings of the PATCO workers all over again. If organized labor doesn't respond to this and quickly and forcefully, it's going to sweep across here to Pennsylvania, Ohio, all the rest of the Rust Belt states up here into New England as well, I think.
And just to make it clear how much this is about even denying basic rights, I mean, not only the coercion of the inspector of the National Guard, the governor's budget for repair bill actually says that once it's passed, if you are absent for more than 3 days and your supervisor does not approve, you can be terminated. So this is clearly an attempt to, to basically make it possible to fire all state employees who might protest this action. And so it's that draconian, it's just a naked power grab, and it will change the power in Wisconsin. If you lose 175,000 public sector unionists and their unions, then the possibility of progressives winning elections in Wisconsin is greatly diminished in 2012, the next presidential election, and all of our state and local races.
Well, isn't that the point?
It really is a power grab. That's absolutely the point.
That's exactly the point. I mean, it's the whole reason you're seeing the attacks on the right to organize here in Pennsylvania. It's the exact thing.
You hear right-wing talk show hosts saying, well, they didn't support Governor Walker, so they had it coming to them. Can you see Democrats winning an election and say taking state ownership over or private corporations and say support the other side? That would be the equivalent, and no one ever imagined that. That's how far we've tilted to the right in Wisconsin and the whole country if this is allowed to go unchallenged.
You know, I talk to my Tea Party friends who are very anti-government. And you look at something like this, and I got to be honest, this is government being misused. This is the anti-government people using government to deny people their rights. This is exactly what the Tea Twizzlers are complaining about.
We found that to be the compelling message, that even people who don't know unions or understand them very well do think there's a right to have a union and do respond to the idea that this is the government stepping in to take away people's rights and that's unfair and irresponsible and unjust. And so that message carrying across to enough people in this state in a very short amount of time is what's going to decide this whole battle this week.
Yeah, because at the end of it, you know, and I have a libertarian streak within me, as most people know, I don't want my government involved in my relations between me and my employer. If we choose to collectively bargain with the employer, that should be between the employer and the collective of the employees.
And it's very well established in Wisconsin and other states, and it's not conservative at all to do this. This is a radical thing to do. It's saying that we're going to abrogate over half a century of precedent tradition and abrogate laws that are recognized in the UN Charter, you know, the right to form and maintain a union, and just get rid of all of that in less than a week. because we want power, and because we want to do the bidding of the large corporate interests get us elected. That's what Governor Walker's doing, and it's part of a national strategy. So it's coming to your state. If we can't stop it in Wisconsin, we've got to have a firewall at some point.
So with that said, what do I do? What do our listeners do? How do we help?
I don't think it hurts to send messages to Wisconsin, especially the state legislators. State Senate is the place where this matters the most. I think it would be helpful for them to think that Wisconsin will look bad to other states or on a national scene. Wisconsin's kind of it's the kind of state that's self-conscious and worried about that kind of thing. And so I don't think it would hurt at all for them to contact Wisconsin State Senate. The governor's irredeemable on this and is out there.
Right.
But the state Senate's going to decide this, and that's the only house that is a close enough margin where this could be blocked, or at least the bill could be substantially improved so it doesn't completely eliminate the right to have a union, which is what the overall effect of the provision is right now.
NotMyWisconsin.com is the website. Robert Craig, Executive Director of Citizens Action Wisconsin. Robert, I appreciate your time, and I hope you'll come back. Give us updates as this moves forward.
Happy to. Glad to be on your show. Glad a show like yours is out there.
Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you.
We're going to take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
Covering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Taking the blue blood, see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome to the new dark ages. Yeah, home run living, right to the new dark ages. And the world might.
Our stat of the day comes from the folks at the Too Much Online blog. Last April, the British tax rate on income over £150,000, which is about equivalent to $241,000, jumped from 40 to 50%. Now, understand, the people here who are making $250,000 a year and above, those folks are paying 28% tax. In the UK, they're saying 50%. So, you know, a lot more money going into the coffers. Critics of the hike predicted a mass exodus of the UK and their deep-pocketed rich folks to the more rich person-friendly Switzerland. But since then, notes British analyst Johan Harry, the number of UK's wealthy applying for visas to leave Britain for Switzerland has actually dropped by 7%. So all of the doom and the gloom, the fear and the smear evidently didn't work. I don't know if you saw this last week. Five people in Allentown died from a natural gas explosion. Early reports seem to point to aging infrastructure. So it brought me to the question, do you know how old your gas lines are? And you look all around the country. Every week we're seeing something fail. Remember, New York had the steam pipe blow up in the middle of the day. They thought it was a terrorist attack. In Cleveland, they had a gas explosion. All around, you're seeing these natural gas explosion in Philadelphia. You're seeing this stuff happen. Why? Aging infrastructure. The failure to, invest in this stuff. And you look at the fact that Corbett today got a firsthand look at the devastation there in Allentown. And I got to tell you, I lived three blocks from where this happened. My house in Allentown was one of the homes we owned there. It was on 10th and Allen. This is on 13th and Allen. We were just three blocks away. Just completely destroyed eight homes, damaged 40 other homes and businesses because of the inferno that followed the explosion. But here's the thing. Five people dead. Whole bunch of people injured. Why? Because they have not dug those pipes up since they put them down back in the 20s. And you look at our infrastructure as crumbling around us. We're going to see more of this stuff as we move down the line. We're going to see much more destruction based on things crumbling, more bridges falling into rivers like we saw in Minneapolis, because the conservatives have this starve the beast mentality, starve government spending, starve investment. Why? So we can give the top 1, 2, 3% of the country all they want.
Taking that spin, you're absolutely right on that. I saw that headline, too, but the headline read, explosion linked to workers. So someone's trying to spin it.
The one in Philadelphia.
Okay.
Not the one in Allentown. The Allentown, they have no idea. They're saying it's probably just old age. They've removed it, and they're sending it to New Jersey for analysis, but because it happened at night. So, it's one of those things where you're going, just went up. And when I first moved to Allentown, to be honest, the same thing happened. It was, for those who know Allentown, it was Wyoming Street, and I'll never forget it because the house was completely gone. I mean, it had blown up and it had burnt to nothing, which I thought was just incredible. But it was because, it had a gas leak and nobody knew it, and boom, up it went.
I'll have to double check that. I'm pretty sure that the headline I saw, I don't know if someone had worked on that previously. But the point is, nobody said, hey, these are old lines, and they need to be worked on. Nobody.
And, again, we go back to this, and we talk about this often. What kind of investment, what kind of a country do we want to have? When my grandparents' generation paid taxes into a system that said, we want to have good waterways, we want to have public sewers, we want to have electricity throughout country, we want to have telephone lines everywhere. They invested in that stuff. They took money that they could spend right now to satisfy their quick interests, and said, "No, we're going to invest this for the long term, so our children and our grandchildren can benefit from these, so our economy can grow." You look at broadband technology. You look at the internet service that we have in this country is pathetic. For the country that kind of invented it. We're the ones who, here it is. We got the latest, greatest tool. We have stopped moving forward.
But isn't that true about, you could off the top of your head name five technologies where, it started here.
Solar panels.
And boom, some other country, principally China, has heisted it.
And I wouldn't even say heisted it, Jake. I would say,
given for 30 pieces of silver.
Basically it. So that we can enrich the very few at the top. And that's what we've done, industry after industry. And you look at today, the big headlines. China has taken over as the number two economy in the country, or in the globe. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But, you know, at the end of this, they didn't beat us.
You know, you talk about China. You talk China is just beating us in so many ways. But yet, there seem to be some people out there trying to rewrite the truth, rewrite history. I heard one guy yesterday. He said, what's this about? We lost our infrastructure and our manufacturing and industrial capabilities. That's just not true. Oh, really? I'd like to ask that man, what state does he live in?
Where'd you hear that from?
It was an interview on one of the shows. It was a conservative, business connected, and basically he's trying to rewrite history. And
well, no, what he's trying to do is lie. There's no rewriting. He's lying.
Well, call it what you want. Right? You can call it rewriting. It's the same thing.
We are manufacturing more than we did back in the 50s. That is true.
In this state alone, we've lost 70% of our industrial manufacturing base in the last 10 years. Clearly, that is part of why we don't have enough good jobs, why there's high unemployment, why economically we have taken it on the chin, why in the terms of real wages, our wages, if you factor in inflation, have gone down since 1978. That was had as much to do with it as anything. Now, there were other factors, but that was key. And you wonder where these people are getting these facts.
Now, you know, I go back to the dinner we had with our new pastor from Germany. And, you know, what she told, what her and her husband told were, you know, back in the 80s, you know, the Germans had to make a decision. They were at a crossroads. Which paths do they follow? They had to rebuild their country. They had to decide if they were going to go one way or the other. And I'm saddened to hear, and they've told me that this year ends that great program that I think is a great program, where they offer people a low interest loan to put solar panels on their home, and the ability to, the incentive to sell back. I guess that's ending this year. Again, a conservative government who's deciding that, well, we don't need those things. We need more free market. We need more free market. You know why? Because, as Michelle Bachmann said,
free markets work. Let them.
Yeah, let them.
Yeah, baby. Oh, yeah, baby.
Yeah, free markets work.
Well, you criticize Germany, and perhaps that is a mistake, Rick, but they've done a better job than we have in reinvesting their economy and their infrastructure. They have a good rail system.
But it took a time to make that decision. And my fear is that we're quickly losing that opportunity because the cuckoos that we've put into power. And I blame union members for this. I blame working people for this. In this past election, you voted with just raw emotion that was bought. The Tea Party, this far outrage, these really wealthy groups who were pushing this fake outrage, they're the ones who pushed this whole agenda. And we, the working people, we got caught up in it, Jake. We got caught up in all this hysteria because the mass media kept pushing these Tea Party rallies and these town hall meetings like the guy in Lebanon. That made news all across the country. The majority of people that I know, they get up and they go to work, they bust their behinds. They don't have time for all this. It's angering and it's frustrating that a handful of people, and the reality is in this last election, it wasn't a majority of the people in this country. It was a very small segment, maybe 25%, decided the direction of this country. And now we got people like Walker in Wisconsin, Scott in Florida, corporate over here in Harrisburg.
You know, you mentioned it. I was listening to my local talk show today, and she mentioned it. She was, I don't know, out of the state or something. She happened to see that they had listed the health care meeting back in 2009 in Lebanon as the big event when it comes to health care. Then the gentleman you're talking about, you know the irony? That man was so angry, and he blamed the government. But when you look at what happened, he was angry because he was hurting. He wasn't getting the proper medicine. And why? He was denied it by his health care company. That's the irony.
But well, yet, so what you're telling me is ignorance.
Absolutely.
And stupidity.
Absolutely.
So look what ignorance and stupidity got us. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Barry Mortimer from the United Steelworkers Union. Back after this.
Come to talk.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, a few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug. So they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
Rebuilding America. It's Manufacturing Monday.
Hello, Detroit. All the workers, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down the line. Hello, Pittsburgh. Steel mill workers, let me thank you for your time. You work a 40-hour week for a living. Just to send it on down.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, we've got it right there for you to podcast, download to your computer, or you can watch the video from your home computer. AFP reported that Japan has lost its ranking as the second largest economy in the world, a 42-year run they've had. The Chinese have overtaken them in 2010, according to data released on Monday. That showed a contraction in the Japanese economy and a strong yen. While Japan was expected to fall behind China in the year, the data underlined the weak state of the Japanese economy, which has been burdened by deflation, soft domestic demand, and, of course, pressure by industrialized world's biggest debt. Predictions also vary about when China will overtake the U.S. as the number one economy. They claim it should happen sometime around 2025, according to World Bank estimates and Goldman Sachs. A Gallup poll today said 52% of Americans already think the Chinese are the leading economic power in the world, while 32% said the U.S. was the leading economic power. And I looked to this shift to China, and I looked to their growing industrial might, and I say, you know, it's not that they've beat us. It's that we've handed it over to them. We've given it away. And we got to start thinking about manufacturing things at home and buying goods made here in the U.S. That's why I've asked Barry Mortimer. He's a United Steelworker member to come talk to us about some of the products that they make. Barry, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me on, Rick.
You know, I got one of these light bulbs from Sylvania that my wife absolutely loves because it's made in the U.S. and it has no mercury.
Exactly. Our bulb is mercury-free. It's a pretty good light. The light that it generates is like 100 CRI, which is similar to sunlight.
You know, because those little curlicue ones, I'm as environmentally conscious as anyone. I want to save energy, but I just don't think they give off the light. And I understand people complaining that they just don't give off the same kind of light. And my big problem is the mercury. How do you dispose of them?
Some places have recycling centers, but not many people realize that. And you know, the average person, when their light bulbs blow, they just unscrew them and throw them in the trash, and that's not good for these things.
Well, let's talk about the Sylvania bulb. What's it called?
It's the Halogen Super Saver. It comes in basically replacement wattages of 100 watts, which is about 72 watts, and each bulb type is about 33% less energy. So if your 100 watt bulb 72, the 75 is like in the range of 56 or such a matter.
So they meet the new regulations that are coming online in the next couple of years that are supposed to make the old bulbs obsolete. These meet all of those requirements.
Absolutely, they meet the ISO regulations and they should be a viable bulb going forward in the future.
And they're about the same price as the little curly Q ones.
Yeah, yesterday I had to stop and get some, and they're about $7 a four pack.
So, but the best part of this, and the part that I like, made here in the U.S. mostly by Pennsylvania workers, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, we make the glass at the Wellsboro plant, the glass envelope for it. The bases come from a plant down near you guys, York, PA, and the capsules come from Kentucky.
So this is an American-made product. How come we're not seeing this plastered all over the place? How come Sylvania is not out there pumping this product, making, you know, pounding their chest, saying, "See, we're an American company. Buy our stuff."
I can't really answer that, Rick. Sometimes I wonder if you know, there's so much on the market right now. The incandescent bulbs are still a viable purchase. So I think people overlook these because they're sitting right on the shelves right next to bulbs that are four for a dollar compared to four for $7. And, you know, it very well could be that Sylvania also sells the other bulbs as well.
The curly Q ones. I mean, for me, I look at more than just right here and now. These bulbs last a little bit longer. They save a little bit more energy. So I think it's a zero-sum game at the end of the road.
I agree. You know, I had some discussions last week while I was in D.C. about the fact that, you know, we're looking at energy savings, and that's where some people stop. The curly Q bulb, as you call it, the CFL, does save a lot of energy, but it's not a green product, that's for sure, because of all the, you know, environmental things, and many folks don't realize that there's regulations or procedures for cleaning up one of these if you'd have to break it in your house.
Yeah, I didn't realize there were procedures for cleaning them up.
Yeah,
I thought you just swept them up and put them in the garbage can.
Actually, sweeping them is not a good thing because that puts debris in the air.
Beautiful.
I believe the procedure is take like sticky tape or something like that and pat it on the floor and clean up the glass. Evacuate the room, and so on and so forth.
Well, it's a good thing that I found these these halogen super savers, because we're changing everything in the house over to this, because as we pointed out, no mercury in them whatsoever.
That's awesome.
You talked about the Good Jobs Green Jobs conference that you went to. What did you get from that? What kind of things did you bring out of the conference that you took home?
There's a lot of good things about the Good Job Green Jobs, but as I said, some of the folks are looking at strictly, you know, how much energy something saves, and I don't think they're looking at the big picture, where a lot of this, if we don't make sustainable jobs here in the United States that are green, then problems develop from there, because if we don't manufacture here in this country and everything's manufactured overseas, nobody's going to be able to afford to do anything anyway.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the steelworkers have been one of the more progressive unions out there pushing for this green technology, create jobs here in wind turbines and solar panels and retrofitting buildings and all of those things that I think are the key to making this country, or the beginning of making this country, energy independent.
I agree.
So how do we move forward? How do we get average everyday people involved in this?
Well, we need to educate. For example, many people are still unaware of the fact that starting 2012, you won't be able to purchase the old Edison bulb that we've known our entire lives, and the fact that they've been legislated out of existence. Many people aren't aware of that, so we need to educate.
And surprisingly, that happened during the Bush years.
Yes, it did.
Which, you know, I tell that to people, and they look at me like I've got three heads. I say, no, you know, this came during the Bush years.
I believe that act was enacted in 2007.
Correct. So where do we go from here? I mean, you know, again, you know, I look to the future, and I keep saying we need rail, we need an energy policy, we need a lot of things that, again, you know, the steelworkers have been on the forefront of.
Well, you'll find that the steel workers are forerunners with programs such as these. They've surely helped our cause at Local 1001. Steel workers have been pretty much the driving force behind this halogen project. The company is kind of let us have our head with that,
and it's pretty advertising.
I mean, Osram, Pennsylvania doesn't advertise a whole lot on it anyways, but they've kind of stood pat with it.
Well, I mean, they've got free advertisers. They've got people like you who come out here and speak well of their product.
Well, I agree.
And you know, word of mouth is always the best. Again, it's the Sylvania Super Saver, correct?
The Sylvania Super Saver, yes. And that also comes, the halogen bulb also comes in a recess, like these recessed light fixtures they have. There's like a floodlight type bulb that'll screw up in there. We make those as well.
Outstanding. You know, I'm changing all of them over in my house. Barry Mortimer, I appreciate your time, and thanks for filling us in on another American-made product.
No problem. Anytime, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Back after this.
Proud defender of the working class majority. Rick Smith.
Can antibiotic medicines, long hailed as miracle drugs, be too much of a good thing? Yes. Two factors are at work here. First, bacteria, one of the earliest forms of life on Earth, are miracles in their own right, with a stunning ability to outsmart the antibiotic drugs through rapid evolution. Second, is the rather dull inclination of us supposedly superior humans to overuse and misuse antibiotic medicines. Every time we take an antibiotic to kill some bad bacteria that is infecting our bodies, A few of the infectious germs are naturally resistant to the drug, so they survive, multiply, and become a colony of superbugs that antibiotics can't touch. Multiply this colony by the jillions of doses prescribed for everything from deadly staph infections to the common cold, and we get the, quote, antibiotic paradox. The more we use them, the less effective they become, for they're creating a spreading epidemic of immune superbugs. A big cause of this is the push by drug companies to get patients and doctors to reach for antibiotics as a cure-all. For example, millions of doses a year are prescribed for children and adults who have common colds, flu, sore throats, etc. Nearly all of these infections are caused by viruses, which cannot, repeat, cannot be cured with antibiotics. Taking an antibiotic for a cold is as useless as taking a heart drug for heartburn. The antibiotics will do nothing for your cold, but it will help establish drug-resistant superbugs in your body. That's not a smart trade-off. This is Jim Hightower saying, in fact, it's incomprehensibly stupid. Antibiotics are invaluable medicines we need for serious life-threatening illnesses, but squandering them on sore throats has already brought us to the brink of superbugs that are resistant to everything. That's the nightmare of all nightmares.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin but the way it is. Everything's raisin but the way it is. Gasoline, groceries, and our hazes. Everything's raisin but the way it is.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. A new Fox News poll, kind of interesting, talking about who's going to be president. 48% over Obama, 48% over Mitt Romney. Obama, 49% over Mike Huckabee's 41%. 56% say they would vote for Obama over Sarah Palin. And 55% said they would vote for Obama over Newt Gingrich. Again, you know, we keep hearing these talking heads saying Obama's going to go down. He's not going to make it a second term. Yet the polls of what's going on kind of showing the other way, especially as we look at Republicans doing some really, really crazy things like the guy in Wisconsin. Let's go to the phones. We got Stephanie on line one. How are we doing tonight, Stephanie?
Oh, hanging in there, Rick. How are you?
I'm angry. I'm upset, but I'm energized.
I understand that. I'm right there with you, brother.
Because I'm looking at what's going on in Wisconsin. If there isn't a massive response, because I'm seeing this as that test ground. I'm seeing this as the PATCO situation of August 4th, 81.
Mm-hmm.
If there's not an immediate, painful response, it's coming here to Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I know that. I know that for a fact. I'm sitting there, you know, listening to you and looking on the Facebook and, AFL's already spoken publicly on it, and if we can get our brothers and sisters, I'm a member of AFSCME, and that we'd be directly affected up there. And if it comes here, my job's on the line.
And those are the stories that people need to hear. What is it you do for the state, Stephanie? If you don't mind me asking.
That's fine. I work for in a county assistance office for the Department of Welfare.
So you help people.
Yes, sir.
So at the end of the day, what we're talking about is making you poor and balancing the budget off of people like you and folks who are struggling.
That's... Yes, sir. I mean, considering, what was it, last year? No. 2009. I can't remember. It's late. When we went through our Payless Paydays, and we still had to show up every day to work, but we were not getting paid for it, and yet... Especially in my agency, we're seeing, you know, our brothers and sisters of other agencies such as PennDOT and things like that applying for food stamps, applying for benefits because they're not getting paid. And if they start to privatize things, if they start to say, well, you can't have collective bargaining, you know, it's going to be a right-to-work state and this, that, and the other thing, then we're going to lose everything we fought for. And people in my job will have to work even harder because people will be in applying more.
Well, let me ask you this, Stephanie, because you're the evil person right now. The mass media is saying that you, as a state worker, who every day goes and helps people in need, you're the evil one. You're the one tearing down our nation because you want all that pay and you want all those benefits.
Well, let me put it this way, and if I may be blunt.
Please do.
I am married. I have 4 children. And yet, for someone who works for the Department of Welfare, I require that same benefit just to make it through the end of the month. I don't clear enough money in my job in order for my family to make it.
But what about that greedy pension you've got then? That's surely got to bring the state budget over the top. Surely that pension that you get is going to destroy the country.
Yes, my pension that I won't see for another 21 years is destroying the country.
But you'll be able to take out $1 million right away, right?
Oh,
and then
no,
you'll get
sir.
Triple your pay for the rest of your life, right?
No, there are rules and things that you have to follow. In fact, you have to, like with our time, our sick time, and our you know, massive amounts of vacation time that we get. according to someone that was saying something on Facebook to me earlier.
Well, the fact is that you get vacation time, and that's something that most workers don't.
Yeah, I get vacation time. I have health care benefits. I just got my life insurance statement that, you know, if I die at work, my husband will get $25,000. You know? That,
you know, I've only got one thing to say to you.
Yes, sir.
How dare you? How dare you?
I mean, really, that's the only thing I can say. How dare you want to make a living?
Yeah. How dare I want to support my children? How dare I want to make, you know, with my salary, I can spend money into the economy, so that pay my sales taxes and these other taxes, you know, just to make the world go round.
May 3rd, Stephanie, here in Harrisburg, they are having a rally. There will be buses throughout the state to come to Harrisburg for a day. Please encourage everybody you know to get on one of those buses to come to the Capitol and tell our Governor Tom Corbett. Tom Corbett.
Yes, I love your Freudian slips there, dude.
Sorry. That you know what? They're average, everyday working class people who demand a budget that is fair, and that state workers are tired of being the whipping boy, if you will.
Of course. I'll do my best to be there, and I'll get as many people there as possible. And in fact, during the Payless Paydays, I was one of the ones. I made the 3 local news stations here in Pittsburgh and print media statewide standing there holding a sign, "Mr. Rendell, I want a paycheck, not a rain check." And I'm going to tell Corbett, I want my job. I don't want excuses.
Stephanie, great talking to you. I appreciate the call.
Thank you, sir. Have a good night.
Alrighty. It comes down to, it's going to take organizing. It's going to take people like Stephanie. It's going to take people coming together and coming here to Harrisburg, Jake, to stand up and say, hey, balance the budget, just not on the backs of those who can afford it the least.
Yeah, I'd like to challenge any of these privatization kings. Come up with one individual that works for the state that's making more money working for the state doing that job than they would in the private sector.
But Jake, show me one. They get $1 million lump sum, and they make triple their salary for the rest of their lives. And of course, you know that their grandchildren get that pension too. I mean, what other lies can we think of? Hold on. Come on, help me. Give me a lie. Come on. Oh, and then
they get long-term health care.
That too, yeah. Long-term health care. And they get a nurse who wipes their nose 24 hours a day. And she's a beautiful blonde for the men and a beautiful blonde male for the women. All this stuff. All this wonderful stuff, this utopian stuff. Yeah, that's what the state workers get. bull. The reality is these are people who go to work and bust their behinds like everybody else. And instead of the working class in this country turning their finger and saying, you don't deserve it, saying you don't deserve what you get, or
how dare you? How dare you?
You know, just because you want to make a living. Instead of going, hey, how do I get that? How do I get a vacation every once in a while? How do I get a pension? How do I get health care? To me, it's a pretty simple thing. Anyway, according to documents obtained by Think Progress, lobbyists for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce have been working with firms to develop methods of deceit and denial and anger and all kinds of underhanded James Bond kind of spy stuff. But they're working to deceive and discredit the chamber's most vocal progressive opponents. You know, and our friend Lee Fong from Think Progress, he reported that the chamber and its hired guns mapped ways to attack labor and progressive groups that have taken on powerful business lobbyists. In particular, people like Think Progress, Change the Wind, SEIU, U.S. Chamber Watch, and StopTheChamber.com. Because, you know, here's the thing. You need to get rid of the opposition. Nothing kills profits like sunshine. Nothing kills profit like a union going, hey, we'd like some of that for our workers, because, after all, they created that wealth. One document prepared by a group called Themis said the U.S. Chamber Watch is singled out as one of the most active members of the opposition. It notes that the chamber, unlike many of its critics, is a politically connected group, making its opponents vulnerable to information operations that could embarrass the organizations. Think paying some sleazeball to make up videos. Think some sleazeball editing them down and then pushing them out as, you know, actual journalism. Acorn and Planned Parenthood come to mind. Think those folks. A six-point plan, I guess, was come up with to discredit this U.S. Chamber Watch, including depicting someone saying, "Here, we're going to give you this document, and we're going to give you this secret document under the cloak of night." And then they were going to see if one group would tell the other, and it was all this James Bond, scary kind of stuff, 007. They got caught. They basically got caught. So James Bond, these guys are not. What I find interesting is that they were going to create this fake story. They were going to create a fake insider who was going to give them all this information because, you know, the truth. They were going to say that the Chamber Watch can't be trusted with information or to tell the truth. So what I'm thinking is the truth is kind of an interesting concept. Since they were going to lie from the beginning, whose truth are we looking at? But I look at this Chamber Watch. They were going to spend up over $2 million to do this. And, my point is with $2 million to throw away on some bizarre spy game, this is what is known as disposable income, folks. Maybe we should be taxing them more, since they have all this money to waste and we have such a huge budget deficit. Because after all, if I'm being asked to take food out of the mouth of children, they should at least be asked to pony up a little bit. Just a little bit. Maybe I'm wrong. But I look at this, and it's really this whole bizarre underground scheme that the International Hit Squad over at the Chamber of Commerce has put together. And, you know, if you think about it, you go back to what I said a couple of months ago. And I had some emails from people castigating me for calling the International GOP Hit Squad at the Chamber of Commerce the terrorist group. Now you see what they're doing. They're going after people. They're trying to figure out ways on how we can watch them, how we can watch their children. There was one guy that they actually found out where his wife and children went to pray, and they were going to follow them. And it was just this really bizarre, this really whole bizarre kind of undercover, covert kind of scheme to make someone look bad. And it's just, again, I think these people have too much time and too much money on their hands. Maybe we should help them. Maybe we should help them a whole bunch. And here in the next couple of days, I'm going to try and get Lee Fong from the Center for American Progress, the Think Progress blog, to come here and talk about this, because this is really an intricate web that they've created. We're going to take a quick break. Right back after this with Lawrence Curry, state representative. Stick around.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
You work full-time? You shouldn't be living in poverty. Not in America. So today I'm issuing an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour.
President Obama on Wednesday used his executive order power to raise the minimum wage of workers employed by federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. Standing behind him were fast food workers who worked for McDonald's, Wendy's, and KFC. Alexis Vasquez was one of those workers. He works at a Smithsonian Museum McDonald's and is active in the fight to raise fast food wages with Good Jobs Nation.
I was very excited, not just because I met the president and the most powerful man in the world. I was excited to know that a guy that powerful is on our side supporting us, and it means a lot. It means a lot what he's done for us. It was just so much excitement and thinking about there's more possibility as well as filled me with joy. Everything he said was just beautiful. You know, even himself said that he wasn't going to stop at 10-10. He was going to continue supporting us. That made me want to do something.
As he took action on his own to raise wages of workers working for federal contractors, Obama called on Congress to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour.
10-10. Let's get that done. Raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10 wouldn't just raise wages for minimum wage workers. Its effect would lift wages for about 28 million Americans. It would lift millions of Americans out of poverty immediately. It would help millions more work their way out of poverty without requiring a single dollar in new taxes or spending.
As the Democratic U.S. president was taking action on his own to raise wages for workers, Republicans in Wisconsin were busy trying to make sure that cities in the state cannot enact living wage ordinances. A Wisconsin Assembly bill, AB 750, is being rushed through the legislature. It would use state law to prohibit cities and local units of government throughout Wisconsin from enacting their own living wage ordinances to raise wages for workers. Governor Scott Walker has already used GOP control of state power to wipe out a paid sick day requirement for workers in Milwaukee that city residents wanted. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee began voting on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union Wednesday. Voting will wrap up on Friday. Anti-union Tennessee Republican politicians are going to extremes to oppose UAW membership for the VW workers, even though VW itself is neutral on the union election and works well with unions. UAW Local 1853 Chair Mike Heron says it was the UAW and collective bargaining with GM that reopened the GM plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, that had been shut down during the Great Recession. Heron says statements made by these anti-union politicians in Tennessee that union workers somehow hurt economic development are dead wrong. Collective bargaining in Spring Hill brought $350 million in investments and more than 1,800 jobs to the plant as union representation reopened that idled auto factory.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. Representative Lawrence Curry has reintroduced a piece of legislation to kind of look at the reapportionment stuff that's going on. Maybe we don't need spider-looking districts. Maybe we don't need towns cut in half. Maybe we don't need streets cut in half like where I live. Maybe we need some common sense. Maybe we need something other than this being in the political realm. That's why I've asked State Representative Lawrence Curry to come talk to us about his bill. Representative, thanks for taking time for me.
Not at all. Happy to do it. Let me say, given your examples in the introduction, that unless you live on a county line road, that should not be divided. I think if you're on a county line and the street is what separates the counties, that could happen.
Yeah, I look at where I live, and I live in a little development. Where the little development seems to be niched out, where I'm in Congressman Schuster's district, people cross from our development, they're represented by Todd Platts. It's a weird little niche out that I find interesting.
Yeah. Well, they have to balance the population, and sometimes down to the end, and the numbers work out the way they've done it here, and as crazy as it may seem, they can end the process.
You know, personally, I look at the whole process, and I say, you know, this isn't something I want going to the whims of the political storm, if you will, where one party controls ends
up. That's different. I think even a commission, my bill wants a commission to do the whole thing, both for the state legislature as well as the congressional district. They up to the commission has not done the congressional districts, and I want that to change. But they're going to be faced with some of those same issues.
You know,
go ahead with your...
Well, you know, I look at what they've done, and I believe it was Iowa, where they actually had a panel of judges who looked at it. They were, you know, not... I'm sure they had political pressure like everybody else, but not directly tied to a political party one way or another. And they've got more competitive races, some of the most competitive races in the country.
Well, it's interesting. Of course, here in Pennsylvania, you know, you had a strongly majority Democratic Party in the last session. It's now Republican. So there's something very healthy about that. I mean, the voters voted for whatever the issue was that made them vote Republican, but obviously some who had voted Democratic previously now voted Republican, and maybe in the next election it'll just flip over again. It'll go back to the Democratic representative.
Anything's possible. Let's take a look at your bill, House Bill 259. What are the key components of what it is you're seeking to do?
The most important thing, as far as I'm concerned, is that the commission must draw the line, and that should be the authority doing reapportionment. It should not be legislation, because the legislation comes from one caucus or the other, and that opens up possibilities for all kind of devilish activity. In fact, the uproar over the congressional reapportionment of the one before that was due to legislation and an attempt to gerrymander. That's the one. You're in Bucks County. You're in the Western Pennsylvania.
I'm here in Carlisle. I live actually in Carlisle. We're here in Harrisburg now.
Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Well, we have one where the congressional district came down from Bucks County, and then as it crossed into Montgomery County, it took out several blocks in two townships of heavy Democratic registration, which meant they were thrown into a pool of Republicans that really diluted the Democratic vote, which was done to defeat Joe Huffel when he ran for Congress. Now, that was a pretty bad example of tampering with the system.
Well, I expect to see that again this time around, as Pennsylvania is going to lose another seat.
That's true. What we do with that seat out west is you're right, going to be an issue that we have to talk about. And that just complicates what is pretty much a complicated process anyway.
So, you know, as I go back to my original premise, I don't know that I want this reapportionment to be in the hands of politicians. Nothing against you, but you're subject to the political winds back and forth. I want a body that is going to look at things and try and like they did in Iowa,
more
competitive.
Both parties are exposed to the same winds. That's the advantage of it. You have it's bipartisan, and so if the wind blows foul, the other side can point that out. And what we have to do is just get an excellent chairman of the commission, judge, dean of a law school, who's familiar with the process and is reasonable. That's the key to this.
Okay, so let me ask you, what are the chances we get HB 259 through the legislature?
Well, we've got to work hard on that. Last time I had some Republican support. They like that. And I think I had a fair number of Democrats behind it, but so many outsiders started commenting. They wanted to change, a much more dramatic change, not so much in the way we did reapportionment, but have the legislature change, have it much larger than it was, and on. That's not an issue before writing a reapportionment bill.
Right.
That's another issue. That's changing the Constitution. Yeah. And you want 500 members in the Pennsylvania legislature instead of 203. That's a different, that's not reapportionment.
Yeah, that's a whole different argument, but let me ask you about it, because we had a caller last night who asked that very question. And I guess I'm not against increasing the size of the legislature as long as we have more representation. I think, I don't know how many people you represent, but I think it's the number.
67,000.
That seems to be an awful lot to me.
Well, everybody represents the same number.
But that's I think the point. I think if that was a more manageable number, something smaller, where people would actually get to know their representatives a little better, maybe we would have more people involved in the process. What do you think?
Well, not necessarily.
No.
They don't come out to vote. So what makes you think that they would suddenly change because the configuration of their district is different? I don't think that follows. But it is up to the elected official, congressman or state representative or state senator, to get out there and hold public meetings and hear from his constituents so he can better represent them. I do that, and a lot of members do that. I think that's important.
That is important. Representative, I appreciate your time. Thanks so much for filling us in on this, and I look forward to talking to you again in the near future.
Okay, super.
Thanks so much. State
okay.
Representative Lawrence Curry, HB 259. We're going to put something on our website for you to take a look at. We're right back after this.
A boy with a gun. I got a picture in my pocket of the lucky one. And I announce the winner on the radio. With my microphone, I do a super show. I wear a cowboy hat. It is my business hat. I'm up till 1 a.m.
The Rick Smith Show, teaching America for the better. Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. The Associated Press is reporting less than 2 years after entering bankruptcy, General Motors will extend millions of dollars in bonuses to most of its 48,000 hourly workers. Now remember, conservatives, they wanted General Motors to go bankrupt. They wanted them, just as Zach Womp said, they should be out of the shop. Let them fail. Let them fail. So these 48,000 hourly workers would be out of jobs. Now you're seeing bonuses for the workers, and I got to give them credit, and this is because you have a union here saying, hey, I don't know, maybe the people who created all the wealth should give them something back. Anyway, they're being rewarded for the company's rapid turnaround. The payments disclosed Monday in company documents are similar to the bonuses announced last week to their white-collar employees. The bonuses to 76,000 American workers will probably cost more than $400 million, an amount that suggests executives have increasing confidence in the automaker's comeback. In the 4 years leading up to its 2009 bankruptcy, General Motors piled up more than $80 billion in losses and was burdened by enormous debt. Their CEO and chairman, Dan Akerson, said, on the whole, we've made tremendous progress last year with our collective teamwork. This can just be the beginning. The company made $4.2 billion in the first 9 months of 2010 and is expected to announce a fourth quarter profit very soon. Most of the hourly workers will be getting about $4,000, more than double the previous record, which was back in 1999, and that was the height of the SUV and pickup truck craze. Nearly all 28,000 white-collar workers, engineers, managers, and stuff, they will see between 4 and 16% of their base pay, with a few, less than 1%, they say, getting more than 50% bonus. So it will be interesting to see how this all plays out. What you've got now is you've got the conservatives drawing, going crazy because GM still owes a bit of money. They've paid back more than $23 billion, but they also owe about $26.4 billion more. The government still owns 500 million shares of GM's common stock. Republican Senator Charles Grassley of Iowa said, since the taxpayers helped these companies out of bankruptcy, the taxpayers should be repaid before bonuses go out. It sends a message that those in charge take shareholders, and in this case, the taxpayers, for suckers. See, because at the end of the day, it's all about the shareholders. I think this is a great story in that the workforce is actually, they took massive cuts. And if you understand the contract that the UAW had and the massive concessions, Jake, that these workers took, this is just a little bit back in their pocket. And I think it's going to help their communities as well. A nice little stimulus, if you will.
Well, you talk about crocodile tears. I mean, these members of the same party really were decrying the fact that they were saved. I mean, here you have an industry that if you factor in the suppliers, you're talking about one-seventh of the economy. It would have been a disaster if the auto industry would have went down the tubes. In fact, it very well could have pushed us into another Great Depression. And they did it for political reasons. They did it, well, they actually did it for two reasons. They're anti-union. But beyond that, their thinking was the Toyotas and the Nissans and the Volkswagen plants would be the recipient of very much increased sales. The American auto industry went down the tubes. That may or may not have been true because there's one factor that they forgot. Some of them suppliers would have went down too, and they wouldn't. Some of the foreign-owned auto companies wouldn't have had adequate suppliers either. So that might have been a huge, gigantic mistake. But to pay these workers for what they did and what they sacrificed, I think is appropriate. And by the way, if I was a worker at GM, I certainly would be appreciative and I would remember that. You finally have management that is using their head and rewarding these workers.
At the end of the day, I think the union had an awful lot to do with it as well, saying, look, we gave massive concessions. You have to understand, massive concessions to save this company. And, their hard work and their dedication did turn it around. Chrysler is also going to be giving some bonus pay as well as Ford Motor Company, who's going to give each about $5,000. Ford has almost 41,000 employees in the factory workers in the country. They made $6.6 billion. They also plan to pay their white-collar workers as well.
Oh, by the way, if you want to talk about quality, I think for the first time ever, the top five cars that were awarded by the top prestigious company,
J.D. Power Associates,
they annually come out with the five best cars. For the first time ever, Toyota did not have one. The American car manufacturers had two. Beautiful. I think the Malibu and the Ford Fusion won awards. And I have to say, I have never seen better quality coming out of Detroit. I can remember not too long ago, Rick, that was not true. They've come a long, long way.
Well, you've got some better engineering. Again, most of it comes back down to the engineering. If you've got people, who are putting things together with bubblegum and barbed wire, what do you expect? But here again, I just bought a car Saturday. We went out and my truck, my Ford, finally died. 14 years, 250,000 miles. Just
took
just,
it to hospice.
The old girl just said, you know what? It's over right here, right in the middle of the road. Just said, I'm tired, taking a nap. And it's about time. Went out and bought a new Jeep Patriot. You know, the kids loved it. My wife likes it. I would have preferred another Ford truck, but you know, we're going to give the Jeep a try. And you know, really a very nice car, and we're very happy with it so far. We'll see what happens. But again, you know, I looked at it, and only 75% American made. You know, and I looked, and that was. You know, that was one of the better numbers. And for me, you know, this whole recovery of the auto industry, you know, much like these bonuses being paid to the workers, should have come with more guarantees that American jobs would be created. You know, one of my biggest fears throughout all of this is that you would see a whole bunch of production move to China, a whole bunch of production move to Mexico, which is why that whole South Korean free trade agreement freaks me out, because of that 65% content rule that they've got in there. Actually, 35% domestic content rule, which means 65% of the content of that car can be made either in China or Mexico or both in China. I mean, China could be the winner in both of this. Stop and think about it. If the South Korean free trade agreement goes through, the South Koreans, you know, they make 35% of the car. The U.S., we make 35% of the car. But the Chinese make 65% of both cars. Who's the winner? The Chinese, obviously. And again, you know, to me, it comes back down to this. At some point, we do have to take on the Chinese. At some point, we have to stop this flow of free, cheap goods into the country. At some point, we've got to start protecting domestic industry. And call it what you want. Call it protectionism. Call it isolationist, which I'm not. It's about locking the front door when you leave the house. We cannot allow them to come in and take the furs off the table, if you will.
Absolutely.
On this day in 1903, President Theodore Roosevelt created the Department of Commerce and Labor. It was in 1913 that the two departments were then split into the Department of Commerce and the Department of Labor. Again, you know, going back to that period, 1903, that whole progressive movement that started valuing workers' rights, because back then, joining a union was illegal. And understand, the people who are in charge of places like Wisconsin, Ohio, Michigan, you know, sometimes I think here in Harrisburg, these people wouldn't mind going back to the days where organized labor was illegal. And look what kind of conditions you had. So when I heard the governor of Wisconsin on Friday threatened to use the National Guard, I hearkened back to the days of the coal mines in Colorado. I hearkened back to the Latimer just up the road here in central Pennsylvania, where the police, you know, the National Guard, the Army, the, you know, the power of the state was brought down on the workers. You know, up in Latimer, 19 people shot and killed, most of them in the back, by people who were deputized by a former mine foreman who was sheriff. So you stop and you think about all of the powers that are working against working people, all of the power of the state, which I always find amazing that, you know, where are my Tea Twizzler friends now? Where are the Tea Party people who see any overreach of government as bad? This, what Walker is doing in Wisconsin, is one of the worst breaches of government interference that I can think of. This is directly taking your rights away, whether you agree, whether you want to be in a union or you don't want to be in a union. This is a right that people have. And what I find just absolutely amazing is the people who hate government the most are the ones who always want to be in our lives, who always want government right there, front and center. They want to make abortion illegal, getting in my bedroom. They want to make unions illegal, getting in between me and my employer. They want to get the government out of health care, but they don't mind when a private insurance company is between me and my doctor. I'm kind of confused in all of this, Jake. There's got to be some help here. There's got to be some kind of group therapy we can begin to help heal the masses, to begin to start some coherent worldview.
What you're saying is they're not consistent.
Oh, yeah.
I'm shocked.
I mean, you know, but again, you know, the same people who, you know, they want government out of their lives, but yet they want to make abortion illegal and they want to make unions illegal, or my right to bargain with others. I mean, it's a basic tenet of our Constitution, this right of assembly, this right of association, if you will. Yet they want to use our government against us. It's really scary how quickly it looks like we are moving, and I hate to say it, but we are moving towards becoming a fascist state, where the corporations and government are married together hand in hand down the road and destroying everything that working people would stand for.
I think the statement is as appropriate today as it was 100 years ago. The only thing that has to happen for evil to win is for good men to do nothing. And all too often, too many people in our society take the easy road out.
So I'm looking to this thing in Wisconsin, and we've people here in Pennsylvania have got to do something. Look, at the end of this, if we in this country allow Wisconsin to go down, which from all indications, there's almost no hope. It's a state like Pennsylvania. There's almost no hope. If the Republicans want to do something, there is no stopping them. There's no minority party. There's no opposition. There's none of that. You have no way to slow down the steamroller. It is rolling down the hill out of control. So it's got to happen. And, you know, maybe like Joe, the caller a couple of days ago said, maybe we need to start looking at recalls. And I know in Wisconsin they've been talking about, hey, we've got to look at recalling this crazy guy. The problem is he's got to be in office a year. It's only been a couple of months. And look at the craziness that's gone on. What's this guy going to do in 4, 5, 6, 10 months? How much damage can they do? And again, if we don't mount this defense, that has to happen. What's it going to mean for Ohio? What's it going to mean for Indiana? What's it going to mean for Pennsylvania? What's it going to mean for for New Hampshire? What's it going to mean for Missouri? Michigan? What's it going to mean? It's going to mean lower wages for everybody. And those wages in the South that are lower will keep going lower, and you will see a wider divide. The alligator, the biting part of the alligator will widen, and when it snaps shut, it's going to come down right on our behinds. And that's what scares me. When this country is at a point like the Egyptians, where we have such massive inequity. And understand, in this country, we don't have real abject poverty. There aren't people starving to death in the streets. There are people hungry. There are people who are missing meals. There are people who are going without. But we don't have the kind of poverty that you see in a place like Egypt, where people live on $2 a day. You don't see the kind of poverty you have in Africa or Ethiopia or places like that. But if Republicans have their way, those social programs that are in place to make sure that we don't look like that will go away. And my question is then what happens? Do those people then rise up? And what's it going to take? Because in Egypt, understand, 2%, just 2% of the population caused that to happen. 2%. If we could get 2% of the people in Wisconsin into Madison, if we can get 2% of the people in the state of Pennsylvania to Harrisburg, if you can get 2% of the people in Ohio to go to Columbus, what's that going to say? That's going to say that labor's organized, that workers are fed up and had enough. Stop with the attacks and create jobs. We're right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
You're listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham.
If you work full-time, you shouldn't be living in poverty. Not in America. So today I'm issuing an executive order requiring federal contractors to pay their employees a fair wage of at least $10.10 an hour.
President Obama on Wednesday used his executive order power to raise the minimum wage of workers employed by federal contractors to $10.10 an hour. Standing behind him were fast food workers who worked for McDonald's, Wendy's, and KFC. Alexis Vasquez was one of those workers. He works at a Smithsonian Museum McDonald's and is active in the fight to raise fast food wages with Good Jobs Nation.
I was very excited, not just because I met the president and the most powerful man in the world. I was excited to know that a guy that powerful is on our side, supporting us, and it means a lot. What he's done for us. It was just so much excitement and thinking about there's more possibility as well as filled me with joy. Everything he said was just beautiful. You know, even himself said that he wasn't going to stop at 10-10. He was going to continue supporting. That made me want to do something.
As he took action on his own to raise wages of workers working for federal contractors, Obama called on Congress to increase the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour.
10-10. Let's get that done. Raise the federal minimum wage to 10-10 wouldn't just raise wages for minimum wage workers. Its effect would lift wages for about 28 million Americans. It would lift millions of Americans out of poverty immediately. It would help millions more work their way out of poverty without requiring a single dollar in new taxes or spending.
As the Democratic U.S. president was taking action on his own to raise wages for workers, Republicans in Wisconsin were busy trying to make sure that cities in the state cannot enact living wage ordinances. A Wisconsin Assembly bill, AB 750, is being rushed through the legislature. It would use state law to prohibit cities and local units of government throughout Wisconsin from enacting their own living wage ordinances to raise wages for workers. Governor Scott Walker has already used GOP control of state power to wipe out a paid sick day requirement for workers in Milwaukee that city residents wanted. VW workers in Chattanooga, Tennessee began voting on whether or not to join the United Auto Workers Union Wednesday. Voting will wrap up on Friday. Anti-union Tennessee Republican politicians are going to extremes to oppose UAW membership for the VW workers, even though VW itself is neutral on the union election and works well with unions. UAW Local 1853 Chair Mike Heron says it was the UAW in collective bargaining with GM that reopened the GM plant in Spring Hill, Tennessee, that had been shut down during the Great Recession. Heron says statements made by these anti-union politicians in Tennessee that union workers somehow hurt economic development are dead wrong. Collective bargaining in Spring Hill brought $350 million in investments and more than 1,800 jobs to the plant as union representation reopened that idled auto factory. You've been listening to WIN, Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Your proud defender of the working class majority, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, it's right there at therickSmithShow.com for your entertainment and your enjoyment. You can download it to your iPod or MP3 player. You can also listen to it on your computer, or you can watch the video, the live video streaming from here at the website, which now you're seeing the camera going around in circles, which, yeah, you know, hi out there. So thanks for being here. Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi. Haley said he was proud of his past. Haley was a lobbyist, a politician, and, of course, a lawyer, he said. And, you know, when asked about being, you know, governor of one of the poorest states in the country, and the fact that he was a lobbyist, would that hinder him at all as president, especially with that distinct George Washington type drawl he's got going on there? He said, no. In fact, I'm quite proud of the fact that I'm a lobbyist, because that's what the president's got to do. So he's got to get in there. He's got to lobby. And the whole thing was, you know, I'm okay with being a lobbyist, and we need to do some horse trading. We need to do some moving around, and, you know, some horse swapping. Like we do down here in the South. In fact, he said, I'm a lobbyist. The guy who gets elected or the lady who gets elected will immediately be lobbying. They'll be advocating to Congress. They'll be lobbying to our allies and our adversaries overseas. They'll be asking business community and labor unions. You just do that when you're president. That's just what president does. Uh-huh. So to him, you know, leadership and vision and all that, and setting a course for agendas and all that, to him is just lobbying. See, because that's what all the lobbyists in Washington do. Again, Haley Babar is going to be running for president, I guess. Oh, please help us. Please.
Anyway, well, what happened was the press was trying to nail him down on, is there too much lobbying going on? Do they have too much influence? And I think he surprised him. I think he took the mantle and ran with it. That's an old political trick. And, for the moment, he got away with it, but I don't think he's serious. He's a serious threat to get the Republican nomination.
But Haley's got power.
Actually, he was well liked. He did a much better job than the last chairman of the Republican National Committee when he was in that position.
I think he'll have done a better job than Reince Priebus. I just like that name, Reince Priebus, and understand where Reince Priebus is from. He's from Wisconsin. So understand everything that's going on in Wisconsin. This is the centerpiece. This is where the plot begins. This is where the attack begins from. And if we don't do something, Jake, I'm telling you, if there isn't, this is the stand. If we lose this, pack the bags.
Well, what's ironic, for a good long time, Wisconsin was known as a progressive state. They were in the vanguard of progressive progress in this country.
Well, I mean, the first state to grant public workers the right to organize, the first state to have state workmen's compensation.
Had some very progressive representatives in Congress. That's the irony. But the last, that changed, though, I would say, in the last decade, it's become a swing state.
Well, as all those jobs have been sent overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Because of these insane trade policies. And, you know, when people are hurting, when people are desperate, they do desperate things, and they're easily misled, which is what this whole T-Twizzler thing was. The big-moneyed people saying, here's the cheese on the string. Come follow the cheese. Follow the cheese, you rat scab. go on. Frustrating.
President's budget.
President's budget?
Yes.
We've got President's budget?
President's budget.
Oh, president's budget.
Proposals.
Okay. I thought you said budget.
The irony is the Republicans are saying it isn't enough, and some former governors, some leaders on the Hill are saying, well, you know, he chopped it pretty good from some really important programs. Let me give you an idea of what they're talking about here. His proposal is going to cut from community development block grants about $300 million. $100 million, now this is steep cuts, $100 million from Pell Grants and other higher educational programs over a 10-year period, $2 billion from the low-income heating assistance programs, and only $78 billion out of the defense budget. Now, $78 billion sounds like a lot of money, but in the context of a $700 billion plus defense budget, there were some people that thought there was more fat there. And by the way, since 1992, when Bill Clinton left office, the defense budget has gone from about $300 billion to $700 billion. So in a space of 8 short years, it's increased about 133%.
That's because we're at war. Don't you know? We're in 2 wars. And we didn't want those wars. We had to take them out. See, we had to go get them. We had to smoke them out. Dead or alive.
If you read all of his budget comments, what he did, he's trying to cut back some of the excessive tax cuts that disproportionately affected higher income. I will give him credit on that. I believe this budget is a pragmatic budget. I think they're looking at the 2012 election, quite frankly, Rick. when you have leaders in both sides, you probably got the comfortable middle. Not that that doesn't hurt these people, especially that $2 billion from low-income assistance for heating. I mean, there's a lot of those people, those are elderly, that need it. And given the tax breaks that the rich and the corporations still enjoy, some of that's pretty hard to take. So he's getting criticized from the left, and, of course, the leadership in Congress is criticizing him. So, you know, the old axiom, if both sides are unhappy, you probably reached a happy medium.
Yeah, but I look at this, and, you know, they called for shared sacrifice. I'm not seeing the shared sacrifice. You talk about all the money they're taking from LIHEAP, which means we're going to hear a story next year. This is going to happen, so mark it on your calendar that I said it today. We're going to hear a story of a senior citizen found frozen to death like a popsicle in their home, like we heard a couple of years ago in Detroit. You know, a decorated World War II veteran found dead in his home because he didn't pay his bill. So they shut off his power in the middle of winter. These are the kind of things, get ready. This is what our news is going to be filled with. This is the kind of divestment in our community that is going to happen over the next couple of years. Yet, the top 1-5%, they're doing fine, and they're not being asked to contribute. You know, use the Tom Corbett frame if you have to. Please contribute. We don't want to raise taxes on you. We'd like you to contribute. You know, all of that money that we handed out to the top 2%. So that we could extend unemployment benefits to help folks make it through this rough patch. I'm sorry. That's money that could have been used to pay down the deficit. That's money that could have been used to keep LIHEAP.
Story coming out of Philadelphia. And this has caused some a pretty good amount of ire. Senator Scarnati, one of the leaders up in the Hill, apparently took a trip to the Super Bowl.
Oh, you're kidding.
And they, one of the energy companies out there, Consol was his exact name, they paid for his ticket, his plane ride, and his hotel bill.
Oh, come on. He can't be that stupid, can he?
Well, apparently he is. Now, according to state records, Consol executives and lobbyists have contributed more than $15,000 to Scarnati's campaign since 2005. Philadelphia Inquirer reported that it's not known whether Consol paid for any other legislators to attend last Sunday's game in Arlington, Texas, which was obviously a contest in which Green Bay won. I do know that the Pittsburgh Steelers paid for some other legislators to come out there. The problem is this, and Barry Kaufman, who's executive director of Common Cause, I mean, he said legislators in some other states aren't even allowed to accept free travel or gifts.
Nor should they be here.
And that this group has been pushing, his group, Common Cause, has been pushing for such rules in the Keystone State. Quote, under no circumstances should he be allowing someone to pay for his trip if they're lobbying the legislature. It just doesn't look good. Not only doesn't it look good, I mean, they asked his chief spokesman, if this would have any impact on his vote and support. You can say that publicly, but that leaves grave doubt. I have grave doubts. When they do that and they give you nice fat contributions, is that going to have an effect? I think the logical answer is yes.
No.
Oh, and he got embarrassed, and now he's paying it back, and he's saying, oh, well, you know, maybe I made a mistake.
Do you think, you know, at the end of this, you know, again, we come back to this whole transparency, this whole accountability thing. All of the money that comes from corporations to our legislators should be open, should be put on websites, should be easily accessible for you and me. You know, I got to be honest, I hear stories like this and I'm infuriated because, for the most part, I defend our legislators because it's a tough job. It's a tough, thankless job when you're doing it right. When you're doing nonsense like that, here's a guy who the voters of that that district should remember and say, you know what, have a nice day.
Well, I mean, let's look at the governor. Look at the amount of money that the governor got from these people. They, so far, you know, the natural gas companies, they've gotten a real good deal. for 2 years, 09 and 010. The state, 2010, decided not to tax them. And by all reports, each year, the state government was denied over $500 million. Now, he's talking $1 billion cuts in education. Right there, he would have had the $1 billion that he's going to cut from education. And yet, he has the audacity to stand up and say, well, I have every intention of fulfilling my pledge of not raising taxes. Yeah. I mean, who's he kidding?
We're going to take a quick break. Oh, man. It's just amazing stuff. All right, take a quick break. Right back after this.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Good grief. Talk about hugging the devil. As part of his odd determination to hug up America's avaricious corporate powers, President Obama has now walked across Lafayette Square to enter the imperial gates of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Apparently, this presidential deference is an effort to woo corporate donors and to show conservative voters how moderate he can be. But does he think that either of these groups is going to give any love back? For years, the Chamber has pretended to be the lobbying voice of Main Street business, claiming to have 3 million members. After an expose last year by Mother Jones magazine, however, red-faced Chamber officials had to drop their mom-and-pop pose, confessing that only a tenth of that number are actually members. Even that recalibration grossly inflates the truth, for the outfit's policies are set by a handful of oil conglomerates, Wall Street banks, and the huge self-serving corporations. Obama ought to know better than to trust any of this bunch. He should remember 2009, when he gave special favors to America's insurance giants to win their public support of his health care reform. Meanwhile, the U.S. Chamber bitterly fought the reforms with a multi-million-dollar blitz of vituperative ads. Where did chamber officials get the money to run such a negative media campaign? From Aetna, Cigna, Humana, United Health, and WellPoint. Five of the largest insurance corporations that were publicly embracing Obama had secretly funneled the ad money to the chamber. This is Jim Hightower saying, instead of walking meekly across Lafayette Square in fruitless pursuit of such deceivers, he could stride across the square in the opposite direction. That'd take him to the AFL-CIO, where he could make a symbolic stand of solidarity with the millions of hard-hit working families being crushed by the chamber's corporate funders. But that's a walk that the president has never taken.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Loan, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters? Rick Smith.
The rich pay too much taxes. The poor get way too much. Instead of schools, build prisons and lock the children up. We won't believe those lies again. God is a Republican.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at therickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download it right there at therickSmithShow.com. We do put the podcasts up for your enjoyment, your entertainment. If you missed any portion of it, you want to watch it on video from your computer, that is there as well. We do all that just for you. If you've got any questions, comments, ideas, how to make this little program all that much better for your entertainment, you can email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. And yes, we are counting down the last minutes of Valentine's Day. February 14th is Valentine's Day. Belated happy Valentine's Day to my wife. I bought her the most romantic of gifts because I am the ultimate romantic. I bought her a new camera. Come on, that's funny.
Well, I I know your wife, and I know she loves cameras.
Yeah, well.
That's her passion, so.
I spent almost $3,000 on a camera.
What's $3,000 for a happy home? And I guess she figured you just spent, what, $20,000 for a new car?
18.
18?
Yes.
Okay. Well, she's worth three, I guess.
All righty.
Some men would consider you lucky, right?
I know. Hey, here's the reality. I'm lucky.
You're lucky it isn't diamonds she likes.
Then she wouldn't have been my wife. Anyway, St. Valentine was beheaded on this day around 2078 A.D. Valentine, a holy priest in Rome in the days of Emperor Claudius II, was executed under the rule of Claudius the Cruel. Rome was involved in many unpopular and bloody campaigns. The emperor had to maintain a strong arm, but was having a difficult time getting soldiers to join his military leagues. Claudius believed that Roman men were unwilling to join the army because of their strong attachment to their wives and families. To get rid of the problem, Claudius banned all marriages and engagements in Rome. Valentine realized the injustice of the decree, defied Claudius, and continued to perform marriages of young lovers in secret. And for that, they lapped off his head. And thus, the wonderful day of Valentine's Day, where we give each other chocolate and flowers. On a day where someone got his head chopped off. Interesting.
I really didn't know that story.
Now you know.
Now I know.
I read another article today on Valentine's Day, since, I feel the need to talk a little bit about it. Which this person's take was that that Valentine's Day was kind of like a spring, the infant and the arrow were kind of a better image than the father with the shotgun. I'm saying that, the girl was with child, and it was a way to get the male to commit, if you will. So instead of the shotgun, they came up with the arrow and the baby, which I thought was kind of an interesting story. Not sure how that matters on Valentine's Day, but happy day to you anyway. leading Republicans have come out against Build America bonds. Again, these are the people who love America. They wrap themselves in the flag and they say how wonderful they are and how patriotic. And they come up with little books like the Pledge, 48 pages of color glossy, 27 pages pictures, mostly smiling white people, 21 pages of flowery words, mostly cut and paste, lots of redundancy, lots of duplication, but still very flowery, very nice. They've come out against the Build America bonds, which lets cities sell municipal bonds to the IRS, and have announced that they are planning to end the program in the upcoming budget. Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican from Utah, has said the program is really a disguised state bailout. They love the word bailout, don't they? Heaven forbid we give the states a tool to help them save themselves from collapse. Understand what the Republicans want. And this is the next part of all of this. First, we got to take out the voice. We kill the unions. We do away with the workers so that the people who would stand up in opposition, they're out of the way. Then we have the states file bankruptcy. We allow them to collapse. We come in, set aside all those pensions, steal all their money, and everything's fine. That's the plan. Understand that. But I think a lot of people are still thinking, oh, gee, the Republicans, they're such good patriotic Americans. They love their country. No, they're thieving. No good. Stop me before I do something I'm going to regret. Because the only words I could think of the FCC would throw me off the air for. Ron Paul evidently won the straw poll at CPAC for the second straight year in a row, I guess, beating out former Governor Mitt Romney by 7 points. Only 3,742 of the 10,000 attendees participated in the poll, which here again means there probably were only 3,800 people who showed up. The results of which offer little indication of which candidate will emerge to take on the president in 2012. But I love that. We only had 3,700 attendees of the 10,000 who participated. Well, that means you had about 3,800 people who showed up.
Did you happen to see any part of it, Rick? I saw someone on TV. And,
I did, and, you know, here's the thing.
It was boring. It was pretty boring.
It was a lot of country music. It was a lot of, you know, grandstanding. It was a lot of nothing. It was a lot of show, no substance. It is what the Republican Party is. A lot of substance. Or, I mean, a lot of show, no substance. There was nothing there. There was no there.
I thought Donald Trump showed some real kahunas. You know, there he is, first time speaker. Kind of new to the whole Republican shtick stuff.
I disagree.
And he told him, he said, by the way, Ron Paul can't be elected, which is true. But what really, really, truly shocked me was when Cheney came up to speak, he was booed. And a couple people yell out, you know, war crimes, war criminal.
That probably came from Terrence Heath in the press box.
But to say that about a former vice president was shocking to me.
Well, it's not shocking at all. I think he is a war criminal. But to go back to the Donald.
Well, but at a Republican convention, to say that is shocking.
No, I don't think so. Going back to the Donald and his coiffed hair, I don't think that any of that is surprising. He is a hey, look at me guy. That was a publicity stunt.
He wanted the
stunt.
PR.
That was a publicity stunt. That was, hey, look at me. I'm doing this TV show. Give me the ratings so I can make more money. He's an egomaniac. And that's okay. I'm okay with people being egomaniacs. I actually envy him. I actually envy people who can stand up and want the spotlight. I never do. I don't. I'm not one of those people who gets up and, hey, look at me, and, you know, does the dance with the lampshade and the zipper down thing. I'm just not that guy. But, you know, you look at the Donald, and I think the Donald is, and he thrives on the spotlight, and this is going to give him a lot of PR.
Mr. Bartwright was there also.
Yeah, well. And are you surprised?
I was surprised that they invited him as a speaker. Yeah, I was.
Okay.
They must have been desperate this year. That's all I can say. It was really unimpressive, to say the least. Even from the perspective that I take it.
10,000 people, though, they're saying. There is no way that room fits 10,000.
It did not look like 10,000.
There is no way that room fits 10,000.
I'd say at most half that.
Maybe.
Well,
maybe.
I mean, there could be some people that were signed up that didn't show up too.
Oh, are you saying they padded it?
Well, that's very possible.
Of course they did. Public workers unions are preparing to combat efforts to roll back wages and benefits as budget crisis threatens them at state, federal, and local levels. Two of the nation's biggest public employee unions, representing 2 million workers, are preparing for campaigns right now so that cuts aren't made too hastily. And I think right here in Pennsylvania, we need the working people to step up, step forward, and come to Harrisburg on May 3rd for the big rally. Everybody in this listening area, everybody listening to this program, should be in Harrisburg on May 3rd. I understand it's going to start at about noon, so there's a rally planned and a legislative action. We're going to run to the different legislators and say, hey, protect us. Don't whack us off at the knees, which is going to happen to working people. You're going to pay the brunt of this, and the wealth class will walk away. So mark that on your calendar, May the 3rd. And as time comes closer, we're going to keep pushing this, because this is important. It's important that we get together and we organize, folks. Have a great night. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the sway. Imperial, mysterious, and perilous array. Democracy is coming to the U.S.
The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win.